coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. Happy Tuesday evening. Hope everybody is doing well. Good morning if you're in the UK or across the dateline over there. You're plus six GMT, all that action. Hope you're all doing great. Thank you, everybody who's been tuning in to the many shows I've been appearing on, promoting my new frequency music, things like that. Shameless self-promotion, artofchristopherjordan.com. As if you all don't know, I'm shameless as it is. Welcome to the show as always, everybody. Always glad to have you here. Get ready. This week and next week, we are live here in studio. Just about the entirety of August and the first part of September, we are in pre-recorded fashion, folks. If you stop on by CuriousRealm.com, at the bottom of our website is actually our calendar, and you can see our upcoming events. August is stacked full. We start off with the International Remote Viewing Association and Monroe Institute Conference coming up. That's going to be fantastic. We are a sponsor of that. We are also a sponsor of Texas UFOCon coming up August 19th. The MUFON Symposium in Cincinnati, we are a sponsor of as well. And Paranormal Roundtables, second annual Dogman Cryptid Conference. We are the AV sponsor of that, and we'll be up there in Dallas for that. So all of those, the next many, many Tuesday nights, will all be pre-recorded episodes. They will all be content coming to you from those events. The way that we always do, we'll be talking with the researchers, authors, presenters, things like that. Next week, actually, very, very honored to have Mindy Topfest on at the beginning of the show. She is the state director for MUFON in Oklahoma. I had a chance to meet her at MUFONCon in Denver last year. Her new book, Dying to Meet Them, is about near-death experience, her near-death experience, how it ties in with UFO, UAP experience, all of that kind of stuff. She's also one of the many members of the MUFON's experiencer resource team, as well as Sev Talk. So it is a double MUFON double hitter next week to kind of help promote that upcoming conference a little bit. We will be talking about, of course, Sev's book, You Have the Right to Talk to Aliens, and what the experiencer response team is all about. How we should react to experiencers, how we should interact with experiencers and open conversation with them. Because much like anybody who's been through any traumatic experience, like, believe it or not, folks, even though you're like, hey, I want to see a UFO, feel free to read any of these books on my shelves back here. Most of those experiences do not begin well. They do not begin with feelings of great intention. They do not begin with feelings of, oh, wow, these guys are here to help me out. Many times they are followed by feelings of fear, dread in your attic or basement, to quote Ghostbusters. But in all sincerity, they are traumatic events. They can be very traumatic events. I know my personal experience with shadow people was very traumatic for me, like being grabbed by a shadow person and not knowing that or understanding it or being able to move or respond. It was one of the most frightening experiences of my life. And even to think about it now, like to this day, I do not sleep with an open closet door. Like it won't happen. It won't happen. Doors in my room have to be closed. I won't like, nope, no portal for shadows. Thank you. That's where my mentality is on it, you know? And we have to remember that sometimes people have had traumatic experiences that they are just now becoming comfortable to talk about. That's what our first part of the episode is tonight. On hold is our good friend Mike Turber. We will be going over the recent UAP whistleblower panel and conference with David Grush and David Fravor and Graves. It was the oversight committee. So the people really, really involved with the purse strings of stuff. So it was great to hear them. We'll be talking about a lot of the response to that tonight, breaking down a lot of what was said during that. So get ready for some clips, folks, with our good friend Mike Turber. Always great to talk to somebody in the world of intelligentsia whenever you hear some of these responses. In the second part of the episode, get ready for our good friend Kathleen Ball. Her new book, A Grail Quest, has just hit the shelves, talking about her discovery of a Templar cave in Brazil and her official grail quest that sent her on, and how that has led to a world of research and a world of amazing things for her, including this book, which is great. So congratulations, Kathleen, on that. Before we start up with Mike Turber, folks, let's check out a little bit of the news of the week. We haven't had news of the week in a long time. News of the week is, of course, brought to you by the Curious Realm Facebook group. Stop on by, join the group, join the conversation. Out of fizz.org, evidence the oral stories of Australia's First Nations might be 10,000 years old. That goes all the way back to last ice age. And yes, the Aborigine people are claimed to have some of the most unbroken oral tradition in the history of humanity. Out of News 4 San Antonio, San Antonio's Natural Bridge Cavern to host first ever underground live concert in its newly discovered ballroom. There is a huge new location that they found there on that premises. Out of fizz.org, thermal imaging innovations allow AI to see through pitch darkness like broad daylight. And out of CBS News, dead body found in barrel at Malibu Beach. That is just some of the news that is fit to print, folks. Stop on by, join the conversation there on Facebook with the Curious Realm. While you're online checking that out, of course, stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That's where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can follow us on all the forms of social media. We have all the links right there. That's where you can go and check out our videos page and subscribe to 5x5 News on YouTube and find their stuff on Facebook as well. We have all of our guests' YouTube embedded right there for you to easily find. So welcome back to the show. Mike Turber, how you doing, bud?
Doing fine, sir. Was that body in Malibu? Is that found anywhere near Charlie Sheen's house?
I think the Vatican assassin himself is a little more sly than that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. A tiger's blood, man, keeps you sharp.
That's right. That's pretty obvious.
You know, he's one that I miss. It's kind of like a good Florida man story. I miss a good Charlie Sheen headline. You know, he's kind of disappeared into celebrity obscurity. And I always loved his career. He had some great work. It was fantastic. But, man. There were just some wild headlines, like that whole Vatican assassin interview where it was like, What is this, man? If you ever watched the interview with Kanye West or Yeezy, rather, on InfoWars with Alex Jones, that was like, what am I witnessing right now? I was just stymied. I was stymied. I don't watch Alex much anymore, but when I saw that one, I was like, oh man, I'm tuning into that today. I gotta see that. And it was like, whoa. what is going on here?
You weren't wishing you were back there now, were you?
no. Good, not in that kind of way.
Yeah, good.
It was more one of those, man, I'm glad I ain't on that switchboard right now. And oddly enough, that was our conversation whenever I got you on the phone earlier, was you You are always getting into the thick of something. It's pretty wild. The things that you cannot publicly discuss are pretty phenomenal, Mike. Let's just say that.
True. And this is why I can really a little bit.
None of this is true. None of this is true. It's all made up.
That's right. But, oh man. Yeah. I kind of wish this last weekend was kind of made up, but it'll come out sometime down the road. But when it does, we can refer back to this, but what a bizarre just series of events that occurred in this particular month and with the particular subject matter. It's just,
yeah.
But we'll have to get off of that relative quickly because people hate to hear about things they can't hear about.
Yeah. Let's let that be our springboard, Mike.
Yeah.
Because once again, we heard quite a few times in the coverage that happened of the hearing that I can't discuss that. Yeah. I can discuss that in a closed door. One of the reasons I love having you on is, A, not only do you live in the world of intelligentsia, do you live in the world of a subcontracting contractor?
Part of what he's saying is not entirely correct. It's very close. I will admit that I have a lot more respect for Grush after the UAP hearing than I did probably before it.
Mm.
Basically, how he handles himself and some of the things he mentioned are.
I definitely my confidence in him is 72% greater than it was, and it was already a good 80%.
Yeah. And my feelings are similar in that I believe that I believe he's telling the truth. I don't think there's too much in him that came out that was lies.
Mm-mm.
The problem is that I don't know whether or not he was told the truth. So that brings on another part of the mix in the classic. Well, none of the stories come from him directly witnessing these events or anything of the sort. So how can we, trust that? Well, you don't necessarily have to trust that. You have to trust the process. And that's what he did. He's going through the process the proper way by filing the IGIC report, with the Inspector General of Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. And as such, he's doing the proper step. So the other thing is that the senators always tend to ask questions, I think, to get more of a soundbite on that night's news than they do, because they know he can't answer some of these questions. And it's like, why waste the time asking him questions that you know he can't answer? And some of those questions, when he alluded to being able to talk to them openly in a skiff, that's not necessarily true. If you're in a program and you haven't been authorized to share information that's in that program with anyone outside the program because it's compartmentalized and it's top secret or SCI or SAP program, then you have an obligation to maintain national security. And that doesn't matter if you're in a skiff or not. The people across from you have to be cleared and have a need to know that information. But at the same time, we have the Senate. That we have new laws in place, new whistleblower, laws in place, they're kind of mixing in several things that could be argued back and forth as to what he can talk about and what he can't talk about. So I'm going to keep an open mind to this. And, there are some holes in his story, obviously. And when you have the DOD come out.
There are holes in every story.
Oh, of course.
There are holes in every story. And before we get started tonight, folks, I want to caveat something because no, we didn't hear where the bodies were buried.
No,
we didn't. And they caveated that at the beginning. Like, if you're expecting to hear about the little green men today, you may be mistaken. This isn't the hearing for you. What they're talking about is the money, and where the money leads is to the compartmentalized programs. Where the money leads is to the closed doors, to the doors that closed in the faces of the senators that were in this hearing,
mm-hmm.
who were investigating it, as well as Grush, who became a whistleblower. And despite what anybody may think, let me explain to you exactly what that means. That means the end of any career or pension proven otherwise.
Pretty much.
End. Gone. 30 years of your life, gone, dude. Good luck picking up a contract outside, doing what you do or doing what you've been doing. Nope, ain't going to happen. Yeah. You have just become anathema. If none of this comes true, if none of this comes to light, if it's proven that you're lying, anything like that, like, you are officially and legally done for. And even at the end of the hearing, which we won't get to tonight, we'll have many, many clips, but one of my favorites was when they said that they were perfectly willing to enact the Holman Act. And
yeah, exactly.
Believe it's the Holman Act.
They did.
Which basically says if you are a compartmentalized contractor, if you're a contractor, if you get money from the Senate checkbook and you are involved in this and you do not come forward when asked, you can consider yourself fired. The money's gone.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if you're involved or not. The money's gone. Like, purse is shut. And that was phenomenal to see. That was amazing. Now, some of the things that we are going to get into tonight are a little bit of the obfuscation that has happened. A few sightings that weren't necessarily put out hugely in the public. Things like that. And knowledge of programs and technologies. You know, there was a big use of the word non-biological.
Right. And I'm glad you used that, because that kind of keeps that window open. You know, he didn't say extraterrestrials. He didn't use the NHI term that much either.
It was definitely asked one time. NHI was asked once.
Yep. But when he said that the biologics were found, that does keep that window very wide. You know, when you say something's non-human, well, anything that's not a human is non-human. So
they said space monkeys too. Guess what landed?
A dog.
Space monkeys. Dogs, just like we from, just like we sent up, you know,
came from the dog star. I get it, and I think that that's a good way to cover the bases and what have you. He's obviously between the interview that he had with Coulthard and this hearing, he's had a lot of either coaching or some sort of prepping for how to handle, speaking in public. So, you can definitely tell a difference. And I don't fault that. I don't have an issue with that. I've never had, training. Obviously I've had no proper training at all as far as being able to speak to the public, but when it is that drastic, then you have to wonder, okay, is this the same type of coaching he's going to have for his testimony to the IG and what have you down the road? If so, that's fine. As long as what he's saying is truthful as far as he knows it, then that's cool. I know you do too. I so want whatever he's saying to be true,
I do not doubt what he testified to last week is true whatsoever.
Okay.
Whatsoever. Never once have I doubted that we have retrieval, that we have recovered technology, anything like that. And once again, the leaving that door open is very, very important for a scientific viewpoint. You know, we do not know.
Yeah.
Now, granted, one of the things that was asked, and we'll get into it, and you'll hear the question asked, is how long has the government been in contact? And he said since 1939. Yeah. So, once again, if you've got friends that do not believe in UFOs, UAPs, great. Doesn't matter. Take the conversation of alien life. Take the conversation of extra-dimensional life. Because once again, ET just means extraterrestrial, not of this Earth. Doesn't mean it's not from a parallel Earth. Doesn't mean that it's not from an Earth in the future or in the past that has been affected by actions here. So those are all things that quantifiably, according to all physics going on right now, could be in the realm of possibility. So to just say it's a biological entity from another planet is very short-minded.
Yeah, I foresee a lot of new terms coming out to specify an entity that comes from our own future, an entity that comes through a dimension, entities that come, via other media. There's going to be some new terms introduced, so we're going to have to get used to that here over the next few years.
Once again, if you don't believe in those things, fine. Once again, my question is, do you believe in a Senate Oversight Committee? Do you believe in the need for one? Do you believe in the Pentagon Papers, which told us what actively led to Vietnam and the horrors and the money trail, the black money trail, things like that? Things like Air America, which led directly to the ways and means by which Iran-Contra was carried out. If you don't like your government taking part in things like that, and you want the people involved held accountable, fired, put in prison, things like that, now imagine that on a scale this large.
Yeah.
Going back to 1939.
Yeah. And the problem with finding any of these is it's so well hidden inside these budgets, especially in the black budgets. Black budgets have, several layers to them that different layers of senators can see and not see. Of course, you have the Oversight Committee, for the Department of Defense and spending and all that. I get it. They can see multiple levels deep, but even they're not privy to very specific items. That are on the drawing board, and we don't find out until later. And of course, hindsight is, obviously very good. But, in this regard, I can see some of it, but if we're pushing for transparency on this subject, if the government still doesn't think that we're ready, that horse has been dead for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I mean, I've already used the glue from that horse on all kinds of different stuff.
And the thing is, the body's ready to pop.
Yeah.
Mike.
Yeah.
Just like any whale that flops up on the ocean shore.
Let the bodies hit the floor.
Certain amount of time before that thing goes pop. Yeah. And
when it does.
And like Steve Bassett said on this show a few weeks ago from the Disclosure Project, he said by the end of summer. He expected a big D disclosure moment by the end of summer.
I pushed it out a little bit, but God, I hope he's right.
I guess it depends on when you stop wearing white, Mike. As to when summer officially ends and fall begins. You know what I mean? We don't have a groundhog to tell us that one. It's a color.
Yeah, I just have Bill Murray come around and he just tells me.
When you suddenly look around, you're like, "Ooh, wait a minute, I look like I'm behind the times. What's happening?" But in all sincerity, that is a short timeline, and that's what I said. I was like, that is remarkable to hear. And he is pretty much I would have to say he is the authority when it comes to DC disclosure. He started the Disclosure Project. He was really the first one to say, "I am officially a disclosure lobbyist." That's what I do, is lobby people like Senator Harry Reid.
Does he think this is going to be a layered rollout, or does he think it's just going to be somebody dropping the bomb?
He thinks it will. What's happening right now is basically going to Tetris things to the point of there's no option but a bomb drop.
Gotcha.
And that's kind of what we've been saying, Mike, is the fact of things are coming to a head where you're going to have to admit. You're going to have to admit that there is technology there that you have access to it and that you've had it for a long, long time.
Yeah. And someone's going to walk out the door with irrefutable evidence that says, okay, enough is enough. Okay. We've been dragged through this. We've been riding this roller coaster long enough. We keep getting promises, and then this climatic and anticlimactic roller coaster has got to stop. And the only way I can see it stopping is by somebody coming out and saying, okay, at the risk of everything, here it is.
And that's what's happening. Just to loop it back before we start up with these clips, that's exactly what's happening, Mike. Right now, we have three people. And there was a huge, it was a long enough round of applause that when I was watching it on YouTube, it cut to commercial.
Oh, okay.
But I was watching the replay today and taking notes of it because I recorded the whole thing. And then went back and watched the same feed today to make sure that like what I'd recorded was still there. All that kind of stuff. So yes, the Associated Press, nothing has been cut out, folks. It is still 100% raw. But the applause for the three gentlemen, you know, Graves, Grush, and Fravor was like a minute and a half long. It was huge. And honestly, any of those guys, I spoke privately with an individual that I know, who was an electronic intercept operator.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say that. And he shared with me a couple of articles that he had been deep throat on. Cause he was like, wow, you know, maybe someday I can share my, things will be clear enough that I can share my experiences because of how buried they are within the onion layer of compartmentalization. And maybe we were there, maybe we weren't there, those kind of things, you know.
Yeah, once it starts varying dates and times and methods and tactics and stuff like that, that's when they start running.
He would risk everything.
Yeah.
He would risk everything. And like I told him, A, I don't want you to risk what you feel is your duty. If you feel that telling somebody that would betray the trust of the oath that you took, by all means, do not tell me jack. Please.
Which leads us to Grush with all of the things he said being approved by Dobser.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to really wonder, wow, okay, he basically just stated some of the things that he stated in the interview with Coulthard, and to say that that was approved, especially as, you know, his opening statement or whatever, that was actually approved by Dobser. And you have to wonder, you know, somebody sitting in Dobser when they're reading this information as he's going to put it out, there'd have to be some questions there saying, okay, he admitted the things that I would say are truly top secret. You know, that we actually have crash retrievals and we have biologics. And we have people that have been in his position and are no longer with us, you know, things of that nature. And that just becomes a huge issue for me when I hear Dobser approving it, because Dobser will approve something if it's said and it's factual and it's already been public knowledge or it's something that they're allowed to release. Sure. And they'll also release things that they believe are fiction, like some of the stories that come out, like Kevin Day's story. You know, his book that he wrote and some other stuff that would cover some military, you know, tactics and things of that nature, but not to the point where they actually revealed a specific date and time or a certain event, certain mission, whatever. So I get it. But and just for anybody that doesn't know, it's the Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Security Review is what DOPSR stands for.
Yeah.
And they are tasked to take anything that's, from someone has a top secret or a secret security clearance and any information that they're going to divulge to the public, they want to see that first. And it's basically pre-publication if you're writing a book or pre-publication if you're going to be speaking or something of that nature.
Yeah, we have a couple guests that have had to submit their manuscripts.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So and with me, I'm just real careful about some of the things I say because some of the knowledge I've acquired were not necessarily through, you know, the specific channels that you would think that the information would normally be disseminated in. So whenever you get information, and you know, I've been called on it. Tim McMillan himself has like tried to straight up, you know, call the task on me about having top secret security, you know, information, and then he found out within a few days exactly how that was acquired. He hasn't said a word since.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to understand that there. The government can bring someone in to any program that they feel that person has an expertise in and bring them up to speed on a need to know basis. And maybe not the whole project or whatever, but at least the part that they need to give information on and do that. So Grush is probably operating somewhat in that capacity. And so some of the information that he's been supplied, obviously didn't go through Dobser. So the testimony that he's acquired from the 40 or so plus people that he's talked to is not people that submitted it to Dobser. He straight up got top secret, information. And he hasn't disseminated that, which means he's staying within the realm of the law, even though he retains it. Yeah. It's illegal to give that information. It's not illegal to receive it.
It's not illegal to have it in your brain.
Yeah,
it's illegal to transmit it.
Yeah, it's illegal to transmit or to hold possession of like pieces of paper, like some two presidents, some
hard files, things like that.
Exactly.
I keep them next to my Corvette.
Yeah, I did too. That's where I kept mine, and
the Corvette, for a long time. The toilet closet,
that's good reading. It's good toilet.
The ninth bedroom next to the golf course at the resort that I own. Three of them. So let's start getting into this time. Because one of the first things that came about, the first 30 minutes or so was pleasantries, but one of the first things that came out was a very interesting description from Graves about a curious craft that many, many people have talked about, the black cube. Let's hear that.
Excessive classification practices keep crucial information hidden. Since 2021, all UAP videos are classified as secret or above. This level of secrecy not only impedes our understanding, but fuels speculation and mistrust. In 2014, I was an F-18 Foxtrot pilot in the Navy Fighter Attack Squadron 11, the Red Rippers, and I was stationed at NAS Oceana in Virginia Beach. After upgrades were made to our jet's radar systems, we began detecting unknown objects operating in our airspace. At first, we assumed they were radar errors, but soon we began to correlate the radar tracks with multiple onboard sensors, including infrared systems, eventually through visual ID. During a training mission in Warning Area Whiskey 72, 10 miles off the coast of Virginia Beach, two F-18 Super Hornets were split by a UAP. The object, described as a dark gray or a black cube inside of a clear sphere, came within 50 feet of the lead aircraft and was estimated to be 5 to 15 feet in diameter. The mission commander terminated the flight immediately and returned to base. Our squadron submitted a safety report, but there was no official acknowledgement of the incident and no further mechanism to report the sightings.
Now, that, of course, is part of the problem right there, Mike, is no official way to report sightings, things like that. Now, this is a remarkable, and like he said, they spotted it. They were really up close with it.
Yeah.
Within 50 yards. That's, I mean, a half mile.
Yeah, and I did a lot of research on that.
A half mile is considered a close call, folks, just so you know. Like, if you hear about, like, two airliners having a close call in midair, like, that's like a half mile away. We're talking 50 feet.
Here's some information on that, and I did a very deep dive into those three videos, and this particular video rang out something to me that I was already kind of aware of. One of the things that they said, you'll remember, them saying, look at the SA, there's a whole fleet of them, things like that. One of the questions posed to Ryan Graves was, of all the objects that had been seen daily for over the 2.5 years that he claims they were seen basically daily, what objects had the pilots seen with their own eyes? And what he stated was the only object that was seen with the pilot's own eyes was the cube in the sphere. And that bells and whistles went off in my head. I think Tyler Ruggeray had bells and whistles went off in his head, and we both down that same rabbit hole. But I actually contacted the company that works with that technology that can create those objects on the screen. And there's two schools of thought here. Let's just assume for a moment that we're going to hear a alternate story as to what he was looking at that might make sense. That object that he described is a perfect description of a radar reflector. And the radar reflectors have been around since the 30s and 40s. And they even used them over in Cuba to make it appear as though there was hundreds of aircraft heading into Cuba. And they could turn on the aircraft, turn off the aircraft, and make the aircraft move at any speed back then. So we're talking back in the 50s in this particular instance. Now the technology is called DRFM. It's digital radio frequency modulation. And this type of technology is a, I'm looking at UFO. It's weird. This technology is simply a device that receives a radar signal and takes that signal, processes it, and sends it back out and modifies it to be whatever it wants it to be. And this technology has been around for a while, so I'm not talking about anything that's super classified either. But anyone listening to this, all you have to do is search Navy contract with Mercury Systems.
I've got DRFM up on screen right now as we're talking.
There you go. So I contacted Mercury Systems. I contacted them and talked to them about this particular information, and here's what Facebook came out about it. The Mercury Systems was being tested by the Roosevelt carrier group during this time. So this technology was being tested at that time. Now, whether or not it was exactly what Graves witnessed, I can't say because I don't have the data. But what I can say is that everything that he stated and he stated that the pilot stated is almost perfectly indicative of what you would expect from DRFM technology. You would see fleets of them on your radar. They would do maneuvers that could be anything. They can make it go at any speed they want it to go. And that's as explained to me by the people or by the president of Mercury Systems. That's who I ended up talking to. And I asked him point blank, I said, could this account for some of the things that we have seen in these Navy videos that were recently released? And he says he can't get into that. He can't discuss anything specific to that. And I said, well, based on our conversation today, I feel like that may be the case, and it would be a very oversimplified explanation for what's happening, and it would be very disappointing for a lot of people. But at the same time, at least it would cover that base. And he said, if I were you, I would go down that road. And that basically gave me the answer I needed to have on that. So that kind of take that particular, sighting and kind of like, well, darn it, I hate to say this. So I brought it up to Graves several times and he ignored it, blocked me after a certain point. And I wasn't being mean or anything like that. I just simply asked him point blank, hey, is this technology a possibility? Because you had growlers flying around that were doing it. And so that to me kind of turned me off to that, It's like, all right, well, I guess, we'll table that one for now and, carry on with the other two videos and see if we can figure out what those were. And that's essentially what I did. But, as he sat there and he discussed that cube in the sphere, which has been so hyped up for so long, and there is a very plausible explanation from it for the size of it, the fact that it was in the winds, except that, he states that it was going against category four hurricane winds. I don't have that data, so I can't refute that or do, but I can say Kevin Day's data actually did, acknowledge that. And, so here's a piece of information no one probably is very much aware of. And what I'm about to tell you has been verified by, I'll even give his name is Edward Teets at Edwards Air Force Base, control of the weather, station there at Armstrong. And come to find out that the upgrades of the radar, that they've had for, years and years and years now, each time someone upgraded the radar, you notice that they were seeing new objects on the screen. And these objects, as much as people would hate to have to hear, ended up being, balloons, which could be seen for the first time.
My God, dude. I've literally got the Echo Max EMA 03IM 24-inch inflatable radar reflector and Solus life raft. Now, it's at walmart.com, dude.
Are you serious?
Not even shitting you. Pardon my language.
My God.
Not even joking. I am on walmart.com. And there is an image of this clear balloon with this silver cube of aluminum inside of it.
Yeah. And those are used for multiple reasons.
This is used for like, hey, we're having a problem. We're going to float this balloon up with a little helium tank from our boat that's stranded out in the middle of the ocean.
Wow.
Things like that, so that whenever the AWAC or whatever is looking for you, bam, they've got a reflective radar signal that, hey, we've got something way out there far beyond where they could see you. So there are numerous uses for these things, but once again, something that can be utterly explained when you're talking about a
And so with DRSM, they bounce those signals off of the radar reflectors to make it, to give it an appearance of multiple targets. And that's kind of where that comes from. And then that's where you start seeing the fleet and stuff like this.
But well, DRSM, that's what the DRFM does, which we were just showing from Mercury Technologies on screen just a second ago, going through every bit of that.
If you read actually what it says DRFM does, I think a lot of people who've never heard of this would go, wow, that makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, it's basically the beginnings of the technology that they have for the infrared laser pods for the F-18. Mm-hmm. It basically helps mimic things so that while they're trying to jam you, you're basically sending out a fake object that they're now thinking that they need to jam.
Yeah, and they think it's real.
So it's there to confuse jamming technologies, things like that, weapon systems that are made to target technology.
They can also make the signature of the radar, just like when you're underwater and you have a sonar signature where you can tell which submarine does what because of the screw noise and stuff like this. In the air, you can actually tell a signature of a plane based on the radar signature and that comes back to you, and they can generally figure out what kind of plane it is. And in this case, these planes have been categorized, and the DRFM modules that Mercury System makes can mimic any plane in the world. And they can also mimic things that don't necessarily exist, like UFOs if they want to, and make them travel at any speed. And he said, I said... Huh?
Right here at the bottom of their product page for electronic attack training solutions, quote, our radar technology incorporates advanced DRFM subsystems and a library of validated jamming and deception threats for accurate and scalable training.
There you go.
And once again, the big buzzword going on before this hearing and during the hearing was our training ranges.
Yep.
Our training ranges are in threat.
Yeah.
Not just public aircraft, because that was in there too, but our training ranges are in threat.
Right. And you'll see that most of the sightings have been during training.
Training exercises.
Most of the sightings have occurred right after a major upgrade. The Nimitz was upgraded.
Yep.
In November, November 14th of 2004 is when the sighting was. But keep in mind that the weeks leading up to the sighting of the Nimitz event, and Kevin Day stated this point blank. He said he had been seeing them for about 2 weeks. Well, almost exactly for about 2 weeks, they were launching multiple balloons from San Nicolas Island, Vandenberg Air Force Base, and also from Point Magoo. They launched two balloons from San Nicolas, two balloons from Point Magoo, one balloon from Vandenberg Air Force Base. That's five. When Kevin Day was asked how many, these groups and formations, what did he see them in? He said they were in groups of five. The longest thing I had a problem with was that when he says formation, I'm thinking a formation of planes is something you could visually see right next to each other, within hundreds of feet of each other, maybe a quarter of a mile, something like that. And I asked him that what kicked it over for me was I said, Kevin, I said, when you watch these blips that you said were in formation, How far apart were they? And he said, over 10 miles. I said, over 10 miles. Okay. And bells and whistles went off my head. So, okay. And that's the distance between San Nicolas Island, Vandenberg Air Force Base, and Point Magoo. So these objects were seen in the air from 100 to 120 knots, tracking south at 28,000 feet. That's the exact altitude and the exact speed of the wind that day, which he didn't have that information. Keep in mind too, Kevin didn't even know that his radar had been improved. He didn't know that his radar had been basically replaced and with all new software and hardware. And the reason why he didn't know, cause he didn't have the clearance. And I've discussed that with him. He said he didn't have the top secret clearance. He had just a regular security clearance and he didn't have the ability to even know that his radar had been upgraded and that might be the reason why he can now see these new objects that they hadn't seen before. So imagine seeing a whole bunch of objects, and keep in mind, 1,900 to 2,000 some odd balloons are launched every single day. Yeah. And new radar systems, as soon as they were able to come online, they were picking these things up. Same thing with the Roosevelt. Their radar system had just been upgraded. Same thing with the F-18. their radar system, the APG-79, was an upgrade, and it can now see objects that it couldn't see before. So
yeah, and I've actually got the patent for the radar reflector that you're talking about. That is a cube inside of a sphere. I've got that patent up right now. That's from 1949. And when you're talking about that, folks, from 1949, mind you, this is 1949 technology. Never mind where we've come with vulcanization, all kinds of things. Upper wind velocities, i.e. at elevations from 30,000 to 40,000 yards, heretofore unattainable, may be recorded by the use of the present invention. So that's where they were in 1949. With these, it was actually filed in 45, approved in 49. So,
and see, back then they were just radar reflectors, and now with the DRFM, which basically takes a signal, processes, I asked the president of Mercury Systems. I said, how exactly does this process work? And he says, well, we've had to have chips that were fast enough to do this because we have to receive the signal, which is coming from us at the speed of light, and process it and send it back out within 1/1,000,000th of a second and get it back out so there's no delay. And he said, here's what we do to change the speed. We put a Doppler delay inside the signal to make that object appear to go at any speed we want it to go. And I said, when you say any speed, would 25,000 miles an hour be a speed you could do? He said, that's well within our range.
Sure.
And I said, wow, okay. And that was just an eye opener for me, and but it's hard to to go into that whole subject mix and try to not have a bias anymore after knowing this knowledge. So,
granted, that is once again for some of these sightings, some of these things, not all of them. It's interesting to. Number one, see the pertinence with which our Senate is actually listening to this now. It's fantastic to see it happening. Right now, we're actually going to hear about the multi-decade crash retrieval program from David Grusch. This is his testimony on the multi-decade crash retrieval program and what it has been doing.
At the time, due to my extensive executive level intelligence support duties, I was cleared to literally all relevant compartments and in a position of extreme trust, both in my military and civilian capacities. I was informed in the course of my official duties of a multi-decade UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering program, to which I was denied access to those additional read-ons when I requested it. I made the decision, based on the data I collected, to report this information to my superiors and multiple inspectors general, and in effect becoming a whistleblower. As you know, I've suffered retaliation for my decision, but I am hopeful that my actions will ultimately lead to a positive outcome of increased transparency. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Commander Fravor?
Yeah. So
thank you.
It's pretty remarkable to hear them talking about this kind of stuff on the floors of Congress right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they have become aware of these things.
Yeah, and that's important. And I think going forward that, I may sound like a negative Nancy in some regards with some of this stuff, but in reality, I am a pusher of this. I want everything to be on the table. I just want whatever's going to be on the table to be real and factual, and that's it. So we can weed through some of the goofy stuff we've had to go through and get down to the meat of what he's discussing, what he's bringing to the table, because we don't know everything he knows. We don't know all of the people that he's talked to. I know some of the people that he's talked to, but we don't know all of the people that he's talked to and gotten information from. And some of these, we've heard, you and I both have heard deathbed confessions, and how do you question that? It's like somebody's, so scared to reveal something during their life that they're literally waiting till they're on their deathbed to offer up information
And how can you question that? You know, it's like, wow, okay, this is amazing. And the circumstances that surround it are also, you know, incredible. So I just, you know, it's what's sad is that Kirkpatrick and Susan Goff, they come out with these statements after the fact, after this meeting, and you sit back and you go, okay, well, here he is. He's putting his career on the line, which his career's over.
Yeah.
You know, as far as anyone is concerned, unless everything just pops up and, you know, somebody says, yeah, he's right. Okay, we're done. But they're not doing that. And that becomes an issue for me that, you know, it's kind of scary to bring information forward. And I get it. I get it because I've been in it and I understand it from that level that sometimes you'll say something. And then you'll go, I hope nobody heard that. You know? but at the same time, you want to share this information. There's a driving force in all of us that when we see something that's so extraordinary, that has meaning for all of mankind, to hold that information back is more of a crime than to give the information.
Absolutely.
And that's the way I see it. I think most listeners will agree. They may not agree with some of the things that I say about some of these UFOs and what they might be. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot more out there that we don't know. And the important thing is that making certain that what does come to the table, so we don't have egg on our face when we're presenting evidence, when we say, okay, here's our UFO of the day. You know, we've looked at it and we can't figure out what it is. And we don't want them to be able to come back and say it's not what we think it might be. We want that final footage. We want that final evidence, the body, the biologics, so whatever it is, to be tangible. And a scientist study it and go, wow, this is actually not from here because the radioisotopes do not match anything in our solar system. And this thing was alive at the time these radioisotopes were absorbed into the body. So it ain't from here. That's what I want to hear.
Well, and let's at least get into some of the capabilities of these craft and what they are. This is at about 57 minutes. This is about a 2.5 hour. I recommend anybody go watch the whole 2.5 hour hearing. There's a good 20, 30 minutes of pleasantries at the beginning. There's one person, Representative Fox, who just her time was a vapid waste. They were all given 5 minutes, and she basically just went off on a political diatribe about balloons. And it was like, wow. Like, you just asked a man about deep, dark money trails. And then as he's answering, went, hold on, because we got to talk about Chinese balloons.
What are you doing?
A tangent.
Yeah, and wasted that opportunity.
Why don't you just ask how the internet works?
Exactly. You ask him, where's Al Gore when you need him?
It's like, holy crap, man. Come on. Here's where we start getting into a few of the capabilities of these craft, folks.
Yeah, that's when they need Jack to fight.
Mr. Fravor, I noticed that in the Tic Tac video, it's Tic Tac like the candy. Not TikTok like the Chinese communist app.
That's correct.
Yes, sir. I just want to make that because my daughter corrected me on that and called me a boomer.
Yeah, totally calls out his daughter in the middle of a national conference. There you go. There you go.
And but now I would also like to say today is a day of many firsts. It's a miracle that we're having this meeting, and it's also a miracle that my wife has put up with me for 9 years today. Today is my anniversary, so I want to tell my wife happy anniversary and that I love her very much.
I'm sorry, folks. I thought this was dialed right up to the cliff.
She likes to say this 9 years have been the best 2 years of her life. So thank you. Mr. Fravor, what astonished you the most about the flight capabilities of these Tic Tac? Very brief.
The performance. Absolute performance. It was...
And you're not aware of any other objects that anybody in the world has, in this world, that has those capabilities?
No, I think it's far beyond, actually, our material science that we currently possess.
Are you aware of any other reconnaissance platforms that have tracked or recorded the Tic Tac's maneuvers, maybe the NORAD system or any of the others?
I am not.
Okay. Mr. Grush, thank you.
So yeah, there you have an actual one of the top 20 pilots in the country at one point. Basically attesting to the fact that, like, yeah, we ain't, and they're pretty well versed, just so you know, like, combat pilots are pretty well versed on what the enemy has, what their capabilities are, what maneuvers their craft can and can't do to be able to take advantage of things in a dogfight, all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, let's just say that they're read onto that. So for him to say, like, no, I am not familiar with anything that could do what that was capable of doing.
And one thing that's important to look at is that the physics of all of this is something that's not understood by many, as to how these crafts can make these maneuvers and still stay intact and stuff like this. If the object is operating inside of its own warp bubble or its own distortion field, then it can produce these effects because the person inside will not be experiencing the G's that you would think that they would be experiencing. That just simply you know qualifies for that.
Well, it was interesting to hear even the two pilots respond to their questions about making these maneuvers and going these speeds without the presence of a sonic boom. And they're like, we don't know. We were inside of jet aircraft. They're really, really loud.
Yep. And yeah, you're not going to hear it.
We were pushing the speed of sound, so we'd have been relatively like within a sonic boom ourselves.
Yeah, but everybody on the ship would have heard it.
And yeah,
anything hitting that, you know, they would have had some sort of reference to that. But if the objects are going past the speed of sound and you're not getting a sonic boom, one of two things are happening. Either A, the object is operating inside of its own warp bubble, or two, the object is operating like the X-59, which is a low sonic boom, which in that particular case is a plane that looks a lot like the Concorde, but doesn't make the sound that the Concorde does. And it's been likened to what a door, someone closing a door from across the street, that's how loud it would be. And knowing you wouldn't really even notice that. So, but the shapes of this aircraft, the shape of the Tic Tac would not allow it for that.
And honestly, beyond a certain airspeed, not really a desirable, fully desirable airframe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're basically talking about a 40-foot long flying propane tank. Is essentially what it would look like. And it's not going to be conducive. It's definitely going to make some sonic booms with that type shape.
Up next should be the clip where they ask actually if anybody's ever been hurt in the process of hiding this
on these lines. Mm-hmm.
I have to be careful what I say in detail because there is an open whistleblower reprisal investigation on my behalf, and I don't want to compromise that investigation by providing anything that may help provide somebody information. But it was very brutal and very unfortunate, some of the tactics they used to hurt me both professionally and personally, to be quite frank. Yeah,
it's very unfortunate. As they say, when you're over the target, that's when they do the most firing at you. Do you have any personal knowledge of people who have been harmed or injured in efforts to cover up or conceal these extraterrestrial technology?
Yes. Personally.
Have you heard, have anyone been murdered that you would that you know of or have heard of, I guess?
I have to be careful asking that question. I directed people with that knowledge to the appropriate authorities.
Maybe in a, if we could get in a confidential area skiff, we could talk about that, but unfortunately we were denied access to the skiff, and that's very unfortunate in this scenario.
So yeah, when it comes to whether or not anybody's ever been murdered, like personally injured, reputations tarnished, careers destroyed, yes and absolutely, Grush said. When it comes to if anybody has been physically injured or killed or murdered, we once again hear that basically I can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, and then they can talk about
somebody's been murdered in the hiding of this.
Right. Now, just so everybody knows, a SCIF is what it stands for, Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. It's essentially, it's either a room or a building, and in some cases, it's a quiet room. One of the ones I was in was just a 40-foot container, like a shipping container that was converted into a SCIF. I want one too. There's one over here at JSOC over in Tampa. We'll just say that that's where one of them is. that facility is set up so that it's just like the NSA building or something like that. When you go in, the windows are coated with a coating that doesn't allow signals to come in or go out. So your cell phone immediately dies.
And even a vibration dampening material on the windows to keep lasers from being able to listen. All that kind of stuff. Yeah, vibration dampening coating. All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it actually has a laser deflection. So if somebody fired a laser for like a laser microphone at the
like diffraction grating.
Yeah, it's a prismatic effect. It's kind of neat to see. So if you're ever in the Baltimore, Fort Meade area and you want to have some fun, aim a laser at the NSA facility and see what happens. Don't do that. Whatever you do,
No. We do not condone that. Folks,
no, please.
Good God, don't. Unless it's a TikTok challenge.
Exactly.
The new NSA TikTok challenge.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Oh, man. But, there's a lot of things there's a lot of things he said that they wanted to discuss in a SCIF, and I can see the reason why what he didn't say is the reason why they were denied that, and it was because some of the subject matter, and I have to be careful about this, because it might reveal some of the information I'm aware of. But let me say this the correct way: the information that he has cannot be discussed even in a SCIF because the information that he has is currently a part of what would be considered litigation, would be like him going to court. That's one of the reasons. The other reason, because there's three reasons. The second reason is because some of the information is considered classified and compartmentalized at the SCI level, which is secret compartmentalized information. So you have top secret, and when you have SCI or SAP, those programs are there's no such thing as above top secret. So anybody says it's above top secret, there's no such thing. But
he got into that. Grush covered that. That's actually one of the clips that I have notated. Is the fact that according to all classifications and the way that things are, nothing is above top secret. There is nothing that's above top secret. Folks.
Yeah. There's only three levels of classification, and that is true. There's no. 26 levels, and there's no whatever. You'll hear some names thrown around. You'll hear that kind of thing done, and security clearances like Yankee White and things like that. A lot of people are Yankee White. What is that? Well, that's your clearance you get whenever you're actually directly involved with the president and a courier, like a liaison, like a job that I'm familiar with, would have that classification if they're distributing the national security policies to the president or the daily briefing and things of that nature. So that happens. And he says he was involved at NGA, which I think I may have sent you that email I had from NGA. That was hilarious. Hopefully you read that. There are things that can be said and can't be said. And the third reason, is simply because there are certain people, that could not go in the SCIF for certain reasons that he had asked that those people be allowed to be in the SCIF to ask questions. That's part of the third reason. There's more to it, but that's it. So that's why. But there will be some openness, and he will be able to discuss this, I think, as soon as they get past certain points inside that investigation from the IC, the IGIC. That's important. So I'm dying to see that. I can't wait for, that.
Yeah, I can't wait until the Inspector General report is actually released on this and we see what is verified, what's not. And I don't think anything there is not verified. Period.
Yeah.
Period. Yeah. Once again, even the testimonies that he got from people, hey, mm-hmm. like, they're testimonies. What are you going to do?
That's right.
Like, they signed an affidavit. That's between the person. That's not up to him.
That's right.
All he did was take the affidavit and take the report.
Yeah.
And he's attesting to the fact that I had people who signed affidavits saying that they saw this.
Right.
That is what's happening. Never has David Grush said that he saw bodies, that he saw craft, that he saw reverse engineered materials or technologies.
Right.
What he has said is that he has been in direct contact with contractors who have, and that he has seen the money trails that lead to the programs that they said. And when he confronted those contractors, they shut the door in his face.
Yep.
Which is why he put out his whistleblower form.
Right.
Because that's the only way it was going to come out.
One of the locations where he was asked about the locations of where these objects may be. Yeah, I can tell you that for everyone's first thought would go to Area 51, and that is not.
They said exactly we could say Area 51, but we all already know it's not there. And wherever you say it is, guaranteed the moving trucks are moving up right after you say it here on this camera.
There you, you go.
Know, like, straight up, a senator said that. Like,
yep. Yeah. So everybody go to Dayton, Ohio as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Right, Pat.
Go to AFRL and say you want to see it before they move it, or just wait outside until they do.
Let's get into a little bit more of this. This is from Miss Luna, who questions him regarding NHIs or non-human intelligences.
Yeah,
helping that's the in reverse engineering.
Personally,
I just want everyone to note that he's coming forward in fear of his life. To put in perspective, if they were really not scared about this information coming out, why would someone be intimidated like that? To your knowledge, are NHIs working with adversarial foreign governments in either technology exchange programs or back engineering programs?
I don't have data on that. I'm not sure.
Have you heard or you had people come forward to present that evidence?
Not that particular evidence that you just espoused.
Okay. On the 19th of April, Dr. Kirkpatrick, head of Aero, had said that he did not find any evidence of UAPs. You also stated that you had, in your interview, that you had briefed him on information that you were uncovering, but that he did not follow up with you. Were the items that you divulged to him pertinent to national security?
Yes. Him and I had a classified conversation in April 2022 before he took over Aero in the July 2022, and I provided him some concerns I had.
Do you know why he might not have followed up with you?
Unfortunately, I cannot read his mind. I wish he did. I was happy to give sage counsel to him on where to look when he took the helm of Aero.
Okay, and then my last question for you before I move to Mr. Graves is you received prior approval from the Defense Department to speak on certain issues, correct?
Correct, through DOPSR, DOD Pre-Publication and Security Review. And
there's that DOPSR that you were mentioning and things like that, where he got permission to speak about certain things, but not everything.
Correct.
Yeah, and...
The DOPSR process is real straightforward. I mean, you got to be kind of careful, too. I'm trying to think of how to word some of this stuff. And that's why you'll see him hesitate, me hesitate, certain people, certain information, you'll hesitate. Yeah. And it's not because you're trying to gather your thoughts. It's you're trying to make certain that you stay within the realm of what could be said or what's factual or not. And DOPSR, whenever you're going to make a written statement or you're writing a book or something like that, you have to submit like the final, you have to submit a copy to them securely, meaning that it doesn't go through a publication process. This has to go to them before it goes anywhere. Yeah. And then they approve it or tell you how to change something, or you can fictionalize some of it and what have you. But the problem with some of the people that had their stuff go through DOPSR is that when it comes out, it comes out in a more fictionalized. Yeah, essentially. And you're sitting there and you're like, okay, well now it's basically nothing like it was before. So I can tell you this, a person who used that system in a way that was magical, that I believe was a wonderful thing, is Kevin Day. He wrote a fictional story about the entire Nimitz event. And I can't remember the title of the book or whatever, but if you look up Kevin Day, you'll see it's probably the only book he's written.
I've got it on my shelf back there, and I cannot recall what it is offhand.
So you actually have a copy. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And that the way he did that was genius. I mean, pure genius. Kevin has been probably has gone through a lot more than a lot of people realize. I mean, he's let's just say he's been dragged along, and a lot of people have not turned on him, but basically
Sailor's Anthology.
Yeah.
Sailor's Anthology is what it is. That was one of the first many first books to come out after the UFO UAP and after everything basically came out and the first videos were released.
And look at the publication date on that. What date do you have as copyright or publication date?
I closed the browser.
No worries. You'll see something very interesting when you do that. But his testimony is extremely important in unraveling what the Nimitz event was. It's very important, and it's also one of the most confusing testimonies that's out there that people are, they conflate several of the stories together. But Kevin Day's testimony is extremely important. I think if anyone watches the Nimitz Encounters, which is the story that Dave Beatty put together, the documentary, I think that pretty well covers a lot of this. And I view that as a go-to documentary as far as what these guys have said, their witness testimony and stuff like this, because they've experienced something.
Yeah. And
they've gone through a lot. Yeah. So it's important.
And she had, Miss Luna had another fantastic question that came along, talking about cease and desist, specifically with civilian companies. So let's hear that. It was pretty revealing.
Last I had seen of the video, much of the data that I would recommend be analyzed would consist of radar data that would provide precise kinematics on the object, as well as the fleet of objects that were operating nearby.
In regards to the reporting procedures that Mr. Garcia had addressed on, as well as Representative Burchett, with the FAA, to your understanding, pilots that are seeing this, commercial airline pilots, are they receiving cease and desist letters from corporations for coming forward with information in regards to safety for potential airline passengers?
I have been made privy to conversations with commercial aviators who have received cease and desist orders.
So the American public should know that corporations are putting their own reputations on the basic, not the line, but ahead of the safety of the American people. And I think, would you agree with that statement?
It appears so.
Okay.
Once again, that's pretty huge. United Airlines, any major airline is more than willing to put your safety at risk to bury or ridicule a pilot for reporting something.
Yeah, and here's what's even more interesting. If you call, if you look up FAA number, like phone number, report UAP, that phone number, I think you know where it rings to, but that phone number rings to a certain corporation in Nevada.
Bigelow.
and we've got Bigelow that might even answer the phone. Call that number.
Oh, Bobby.
So we got Robert Bigelow has basically taken over the FAA's UAP reporting hotline. And so when you call that number, that's where you're going to get. You're going to get to the Bass Corporation. So Bigelow Aerospace is where that goes in that repository. And then of course you've got MUFON that gets information as well. I've submitted my UFO sighting, which was last year to MUFON. Of course they wanted me to
I'm
be
a big as all my listeners know, I'm a huge supporter of MUFON. I mean, this show sponsors their annual conference coming up.
Absolutely.
I'm a big believer in the work of MUFON, and I know that many people in the community out there Papu MUFON, things like that. I'm sorry, folks, but there is space inside of these phenomena for some of the really, really wild after effects of people's experiences. Let me just put it that way, where they are frequency shifted, let's just say, into other things. And we'll get into some of that next week with Sev Talk, that kind of stuff.
And as much as I'm a skeptic on the whole, on a lot of the issues, I'm not a skeptic to the point where I don't believe in aliens and stuff like that. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
But as much as me being a skeptic, I am, or that English didn't come out very good. I absolutely believe in the importance of MUFON. I believed in the importance of what ATIP was supposedly what we were told it was going to be, which is an aerospace threat identification program. And the original thing was to study things like drones and things that are coming into our airspace and categorizing these things so that pilots would know immediately what they are. That is all super important to me. Where it gets convoluted is where things like ATIP was wrapped up in OSAP, which actually ended up being a spinoff of Skinwalker Ranch. And you're thinking, wait, what?
I'm very happy to see what's happening with Arrow. And their recent, like the PowerPoint that the good doctor puts on, where it actively shows all of the similarities, and these are the kind of craft that we're talking about, and these are the radiological anomalies, these are the radar anomalies, like they've done some good categorization very rapidly, considering the almost hodgepodge way in which some of this data was collected. Now, granted, the one thing I will say forever and a day is that MUFON's been collecting things in the same fashion and in the same way for decades, almost 50 years.
I would love to. One of the things I proposed a while back to a certain individual is that if we have exact data, like we have EXIF data, metadata, or any data that pinpoints a location, a geographic location, at a certain time, that be cross-referenced to all of our databases of satellite imagery. And so that we can go back and confirm, you know, that these objects were, that something was there. Because some of the sizes of these things, if something's the size of a football field, you'll definitely see it even on a 30-centimeter resolution, you know, satellite, much less a 2 to 2.5-centimeter resolution on a KH series. So, yeah, I think that that should be a program put into place. I would be more than happy to run that program. I have experience in tasking satellites. I have experience
They talked about the Vandenberg incident and the football field size craft that was seen by Lockheed employees.
And the Chicago incident and Phoenix Lights and all of these different incidents, day or night, you know, and I get some of the imagery that I'm familiar with. Yeah, Stevensville, and some of the imagery that I know can't be released, even though Trump released one of the Iranian rocket launch thing, but you know, some of the resolution thing can't be released. But at least internal to the Department of Defense have a classified version of the program. I get it, because we're having classified versions of these hearings. So if there has to be a classified version of, yeah, we found it and we ended up finding it with the keyhole, you know, with KH series satellite, one of the Casals, that's important. And say, yes, we have information. Unfortunately, this image was captured by a satellite that we can't really show you the image, but they can confirm whether or not something was there.
And that's exactly what it's great to see the head of Arrow doing. That was a lot of the conversation with the NASA panel whenever we covered that, Mike, was the fact of, and I loved the way that he laid it down straight up, like, hey, I got access to instruments you dream you had.
And I'll
can't
be talking
point them at somebody's backyard in Poughkeepsie. That's illegal. And you don't want us to go through the legal measures to make it legal?
we were doing that a lot.
That would be bad. That would be bad. However, all of you agencies, NOAA, every one of you civilian agencies have satellites that are looking at the backyards in Poughkeepsie every day to look at average rainfall, weather. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how we get all of our weather information. If they can see 1.6 to 1.8 gigahertz, hey, man, let's start sharing data.
Yeah. And Maxar is building a lot of the current generations of satellites. You know, Lockheed builds, obviously, the Hubble telescope, which is quite clear that they built the KH series of satellites. NRO operate. So you have all of these tools that are available to you, and yet someone at some point in time would have to come forward and say that. You know, back in the day when I could like log in and type up a satellite and say I want a 15 degree oblique on a 10% or less cloudy day or cloudy night, imagery of a 75 mile swath from blah 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 coordinates to blah blah blah, and it may take a day or so to get that data back, but you got it back and you're just amazed at what you're looking at. And I would love to go back and say, now I have a new reason to do that. It's not because we're trying to rescue people out of Afghanistan. It's just now at this point I'm trying to find these objects, and man, we should be able to do that. And if we have to de-resolve, which is where you take the resolution like 2.5 centimeters and bring it up to 30 centimeters, which is what's releasable to the public, do that.
Exactly. And speaking of what's releasable to the public, what's not, the next question's a biggie. It's a big one, talking about non-human origin craft, about if the programs that have access to them or the recovered technology are sanctioned or not. Let's hear that and the response to it, Mike.
It came out of the bottom of it. But other than that, no windows, no seams, no nothing.
Mr. Grush, as a result of your previous government work, have you met with people with direct knowledge or have direct knowledge yourself of non-human origin craft?
Yes, I personally interviewed those individuals.
Mr. Grush, as a result of your previous government work, have you met with people with direct knowledge or have direct knowledge yourself about ATs, advanced technologies that the U.S. government has?
Based on conventional advanced tech, I was briefed to the preponderance of the Defense Department's both space and aerospace compartmented programs, yeah.
Do you have knowledge or do you have reason to believe that there are programs in the advanced tech space that are unsanctioned?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you say that they're above congressional oversight, what do you mean?
Complicated question. So there's, some, I would call it abuse here. So congressional oversight of conventional special access programs, so I'll use Title 10, so DOD as an example, right? So 10 U.S. Code Section 119 discusses congressional oversight of SAPs, discusses the DepSecDef's ability to waive congressional reporting. However, the Gang of Eight is at least supposed to be notified if a waived or waived bigoted unacknowledged SAP is created, and that's public law.
Well, so then how does, I don't want to cut you off, but how does a program like that get funded?
I will give you generalities. I can get very specific in a closed session, but a misappropriation of funds and
Does that mean that there is money in the budget that is said to go to a program, but it doesn't, and it goes to something else?
Yes, I have specific knowledge of that. Yep.
Do you think U.S. corporations are overcharging for certain tech they're selling to the U.S. government, and that additional money is going to programs?
Correct, through something called IRAD.
Okay. Let's talk about satellite imagery. We have satellite.
And that's where they start going into Aero and using the imagery from cross platforms like we were just talking about. But to hear him talk about that straight up, no bones about it. Like, yep, I have specific knowledge of that. I have specific knowledge of the fact that there are non-human craft.
Right.
The contractors have access to them and that these programs are unsanctioned.
And see, that information alone would be considered top secret. And for him to be able to say it openly and that to be approved by DOPSER makes my head spin. I'm trying to figure out how in the world that happened, I'm very much wanting to figure that one out.
Well, and, once again, I think it's to the fact, Mike, that we're verging on technologies that, and in the, not just in the private sector, but in the military sector and in regular use. How many articles have I sent you in the last 2 weeks about room temperature semiconductors.
Oh yeah.
You know, this is stuff that has been science fantasy. When you're talking about fusion reactors, not fission, that kind of stuff, it's yeah. And we're talking, you know, even fission reactors big enough to that are about the size of your home car that can fit into an F-18.
Yep. We've been talking about that for years. And back to that Lockheed video that we touched on. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've been pounding that nail for at least a good 5 years, the Skunk Works video. but that's just it. You know, these are, and like he said, they're a specific trade craft to flip flopping that money and making it disappear. And are they overcharging for technologies that they're selling and using that money to reverse engineer that stuff? Yes. And apparently, so it's pretty remarkable. And the next piece is, I think, really one of the bombshells. And once again, whether or not you believe in craft from another planet, time or place, or even dimension, whether or not you buy into any of that, folks, whether you think this is all smoke and mirrors, the question comes down to accountability, money, and do we hold people responsible? No different than Iran, Contra, Pentagon Papers, things like that. And to think of it in that way, and to think of this as an obfuscation of, I mean, think of it in this way. Think of it if your employer or your employee was hiding this from you for 50 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
How would you feel about it? Would you want them to answer for it? Because they're our employee. So let's hear about that real quick. This is about an hour and 25 minutes into things, folks. So we are not covering the whole thing. Sorry. Please feel free to go watch it. It is available all over the place. But we are covering some key points and issues that were covered. And this is one of them. If the U.S. government has had contact, since when?
Direct this, I believe, to Mr. Grush, but if any of you all feel like you need to jump in, just jump right in. We're good. Has the U.S. government become aware of actual evidence of extraterrestrial, otherwise unexplained forms of intelligence? And if so, when do you think this first occurred?
I like to use the term non-human. I don't like to denote origin. Keeps the aperture open, both scientifically. Right. Certainly, like I've discussed publicly previously, 1930s.
Okay.
That's a hot tater, man.
Yeah.
That's a hot tater.
And you have to wonder, you know, what was the situation like in the 30s? What were they looking at then? And what are they looking at now? Because that predates many of the studies of UAP UFOs. And you have to look at it like, okay, well, where, you know, the term flying saucer hadn't even been coined yet.
That was 1966.
Exactly.
No, so well, coming of the saucers was 1966. I want to say the actual incident in Washington State from the pilot, right, Kevin Arnold, was like 1958.
I think it may have even been right around the time of Roswell.
May have been 48. Yeah. But so yeah.
It's different. But, you know, a lot of that over time, you know, several different entities inside the government would have studied that program. Eventually, most of it going to the Air Force, and then the Navy taking over their portion of it, you know, more recently. But you know, you've got these different agencies, different parts of the armed forces that study this stuff. And then, of course, you have the FAA that has their somewhat variation of it because they have to report stuff as well. But any of this dating back to actual craft and entities, you know, that we have met with, that brings a whole new perspective to this whole thing, you know.
And whether or not the government has met with them, I don't think that was part of the question in all actuality. What it really was Is the U.S. government aware of these intelligences? And if so, since when? So that means they recovered the first craft. We saw the first crash. What have you? And this intelligence may again be a bioorganic robot. It may be an intelligent craft that was sent as a probe. Who knows?
Yeah.
But NHI, non-human intelligence, is how it is being put. And I think rightfully so, once again, to assume that all or any are from a planet beyond is assumptive. Until we have all actuality in front of us, you know. And let's the last few clips go into top secret, who classifies things, and contractors, stuff like that. So let's go ahead and hear real quick about the classification levels and how that comes about.
Welcome to. What level of security clearance is required to fully access these programs?
Well, anybody who has...
I say that because myself, Representative Gates and Representative Luna were basically turned away at one point at Eglin. So please go right ahead.
Certainly a difference between member access and, say, somebody like me, but anybody who has a TSSCI clearance and meets the eligibility criteria, the access adjudicative authority should be able to grant you access.
Ms. Burchard, if you'll yield, so just to put a fine point on that, there's nothing that you're aware of that's above special access program classification.
It's a misnomer that there's anything actually above top secret. Executive Order 13526 delineates the classification levels.
Right. But I draw a point on that because we can have access to those programs. And so the notion that we're not being given that access sort of defies our typical muscle memory here in Congress. Thank you, Mr. Burchard. I'll yield back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Gates.
I like the way you said that. It defies our typical muscle memory here in Congress. You know, we're used to actually being the ones in charge of these purse strings and where the money goes and comes from. And so, yeah, it's strange for us not to have answers when we ask them, and to have doors literally closed in our face when we come to ask them.
They're getting closer to the truth, and the doors are starting to shut. You know, the Department of Defense has a big ego problem, and they have to remember that they are operated by the people, by the government, and it doesn't go the other way around. I understand that matters of national security should be kept from certain entities and whatever. I get it. I fully get it.
Oh, classification. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you have to keep the numbers down to a very low number. And you can't have just everybody that has a top secret security clearance with FBI capability going in and seeing these things. This doesn't work that way. So they have to keep the number small for a reason. But you have to trust the person that did go see it and say, okay, well, I went in there and yes, I was satisfied that the answers to the questions that I had were answered. And well, what questions did you ask? Well, I can't say that because the answer would be classified. The question is classified.
Yeah. If I told you the answer to the question, that would tell you the question, which I told you I couldn't tell you.
Right. Which gets into a circle jerk.
And that's perfectly understandable. But once again, when Grush, whose job it is to get those answers, has the door slammed in his face, and then Congress, the actual Appropriations Committee members, three of the gang of eight, go to get the answers from the same people, and they both have doors shut in their face. And he called them out. That's what I love about this senator. Yeah. He don't care, dude. He called out his daughter for calling him a boomer. Like, you're going to mic drop me? All right, I got you. Hold on. And he calls this out, too. Like, it's great. It's fantastic to hear him like, yeah, you know, Edlund Air Force Base, we went to get answers and they told us no. So what'd they tell you?
Or here's one thing that I learned about, that one of the issues that they brought up, I can't say which one, was to say that the understanding of them being denied access was kind of misrepresented, and that they requested information about a certain thing and was told no. And they, but the no wasn't a no as in, no, we have this and we're not going to show it to you. The no was, we don't have this, and no, you can't have unfiltered access to this certain area of our base. That was part of the issue. I'm very familiar with Eglin, very familiar with Tyndall, very, you know, all these bases in that area. And there are certain things, that go on there, that those are off limits to basically everyone. If you, you know, so I think that part of that is misrepresented or misunderstood in that they were told, no, they can't have access to that area. And then they took it as, no, they can't have access. But no, it's just no one can have access to some of that area. So that was one of them. That doesn't account for all of them, but I know one of those was at least that kind of response.
Yeah, yeah. And
we'll probably hear about that.
Let's get into a little bit of who decides all of that.
Even that access sort of defies our typical muscle memory here in Congress. Thank you, Mr. Burchett. I'll yield back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Gates. Along those lines, Title 10, you may not know this or not, but Title 10 and Title 50 authorization, they seem to say they're inefficient. So who gets to decide this, in your opinion, in the past?
It's a group of career senior executive officials.
Okay. Are they government officials?
Both in and out.
Do what?
Both in and out of government, and that's about as far as I
can
go there.
Yeah. All right. Well, that leads to my next question. Which private corporations are directly involved in this program? How much taxpayer money has been invested in these programs, to your knowledge? I mean, we know we audit the Pentagon every year, and I've been here 5 years, and they failed the dadgum thing every year. They lose over $1 billion a year, we think, and I was told the Department of Defense maybe 60% of their assets are unaccounted for, whatever the heck that means. In the public sector, you go to jail for that kind of crap. So tell me.
Yeah, I know when I'm a dollar off of my DTS travel voucher, I get hammered, but it seems like it doesn't work the other way.
If you sell over $600 worth of stuff on eBay now, you get a call from the IRS. So please, what?
Yeah, I don't know the specific metrics towards the end of your question. The specific corporations I did provide to the committees in specific divisions, and I spent 11 and a half hours with both Intel committees. So.
Okay, has there been an active U.S. government disinformation campaign to deny the existence of unidentified aerial phenomena? And if so, why?
I can't go beyond what I've already espoused publicly about that.
And they ask him what he's espoused and basically exactly what he said earlier. And it's interesting to hear them go down that rabbit trail of conversation. Like he said, if you were in the private sector and this happened, if you were unaccounted for 60%, you'd be audited.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, I think there's, you know, people need to know what Title 10 and Title 50 refer to.
Oh, sure. Please.
So Title 10 is more of a reference towards the military and how the military handles information and the dissemination of it and the budgetary requirements and blah, blah, blah. It's a very broad thing that the military uses. The Title 50 is more or less towards the intelligence agencies and how the intelligence agencies handle that and disseminate it and who they disseminate the information to and what have you. So, you know, that will probably give you an idea. So sometimes they'll intertwine the two when they're referring to the military, they'll talk about both because it's hard to tell where the military ends and the civilian world begins. Like NSA is not a civilian agency. It actually falls under the Department of Defense.
Yep.
Whereas CIA is a civilian agency and does not fall under the Department of Defense. But as we all know, NSA and CIA work together hand in hand. In a lot of cases, NSA obviously concentrates on foreign gathering and intelligence of foreign nations and stuff like that, whereas the CIA would handle the actual operations of going to those locations and putting agents there and gathering, you know, human information and so forth. And of course, everything else you've seen in movies. But the bigger picture here is the Senate has to have some sort of oversight, and the title 10 and Title 50 is supposed to give them some guide as to how to acquire that and how to work through what's considered transparency. Whereas you may not get that for specific reasons on a Title 10 request, yeah. but on a Title 50, you might. So it's a lot of debate about that. So that's a whole show just in that alone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it, man. The acronyms get thick in this stuff whenever you're listening to it. AGSAC, AGSCOB. It's alphabet soup, folks, quite literally, for those that are uninitiated. That's one reason why I wanted to have you on. Even the concept of SCIF, you know, most people don't understand what that is, that it's like a quiet room that you can go to.
And some people of a small business.
The last question we have came actually from Ocasio-Cortez, and I was pretty happy with her question. It came down to contractors and witnesses. A lot of these folks, everybody said and repeated a lot of the same stuff. They echo chambered a lot of themselves. Once again, there were no green aliens trotted out.
All right.
Sorry. But what did come out, maybe the answers that did come, are big. They're friggin' huge. And they hold huge implications. Huge implications. Yep. So let's hear this last question that we're going to cover anyway. I encourage everybody to go look this up on YouTube. Associated Press is who we were watching. That's always one of my go-tos. And everything that they have there is still, like I said, I recorded it as it happened and downloaded it to have the whole thing. And it's all there. So nothing has been edited or redacted. But let's hear this from Ms. Ocasio-Cortez real quick.
Created in the 2020 NDAA, correct?
Yes.
There have been some things that that have been mentioned here during this hearing that I wanted to pick up on. Mr. Graves, you mentioned specifically during the answers to one of your questions, you named Boeing contractors being engaged in an incident regarding this red cube
Boeing.
About a football,
not Lockheed,
football field wide. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the interaction, or Mr. Grush, either of you, the interactions between defense contractor companies and any UAP-related programs or activities.
So I'll just say that the information about the contractor himself were provided by a witness, and I have no particular
Understood.
Detail in that relationship.
Mr. Grush.
The kind of general unclassed wave tops, certainly the contractors, you know, are the metal benders, so to speak, mm-hmm. They're the ones actually doing specific performance on government contracts.
Are they required to issue any disclosure regarding UAP sightings, or do they engage in any reporting around this?
In terms of the contractors?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of.
They do not. Okay. Now, when it comes to notification that you had mentioned about IRAD programs, we have seen defense contractors abuse their contracts before through this committee. I have seen it personally, and I have also seen the notification requirements to Congress abused. I am wondering, one of the loopholes that we see in the law is that there is, at least from my vantage point, is that depending on what we're seeing, is that there are no actual definitions or requirements for notification. Are there... What methods of notification did you observe? Like when they say they notified Congress, how did they do that? Do you have insight into that?
For certain IRAD activities, I can only think of ones conventional in nature. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they flow through certain, I'll just say, SAP programs that have cognizant authority over the Air Force or something. And those are congressionally reported compartments, but IRAD is literally internal to the contractor, mm-hmm. So as long as it's money, either profits, private investment, et cetera, they can do whatever they want.
To put a finer point on it, when there is a requirement for any agency or company to notify, or any agency to notify Congress, do they contact the chairman of a committee? Do they get them on the phone specifically? Is this through an email to hypothetically a dead email box?
A lot of it comes through what they call the PPR, Periodic Program Review Process. Mm-hmm. If it's a SAP or controlled access.
So, yeah, it's once again, obfuscated processes, things like that, that everything goes through and runs through contractors, all that kind of stuff, along in tandem with going to congressional reporting.
Yeah, and just so people know that IRAD is just the initials for Independent Research and Development. That's what that stands for. And essentially, any organization that does any type of technological or deals with electronics or supplies the military or is a manufacturer or supplier of anything, whether it be software or hardware, they have their own independent research and development. And as such, is some of the profits that may come from their activities and dealing with government contracts is to spin off into their own IRAD to further develop those technologies.
Sure.
That's kind of what's happening. Now, there is
subdivisions, sub-companies, subsidiaries, things like that.
Yeah, it's like the Skunk Works division of Lockheed. You know, that's a classic example of an IRAD that has truly we've benefited from. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to really knock that, but at the same time, if Lockheed requests $1 billion to build a satellite and they take $500 million of that $1 billion and send it to Skunk Works and says, hey, make a UAV out of this, then that would be an issue. And I can see that. But overall, I think what's happening is some of the profits that are being funneled off into these other programs is probably for legitimate purposes to better advance, you know, future technology for our own use. So I get it.
Sure.
Who knows where that argument will go? Because Congress would have a reason to ask that question, and I'm sure there's obviously some misappropriations that's going on.
Oh, absolutely.
And that happens in any corporation or any entity, and so that's
those
what
misappropriations are how we end up with Iran-Contra. They're how we end up with Pentagon Papers
and Velcro.
And Intel, yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. And we have to be careful. And it's good to see a bipartisan group of people holding these contractors accountable. And once again, to see them at the end of it say, like, we are willing to enact the Holman Act to hold back the money and close the purse.
Right.
Like,
right.
You will lose your contract. We're here to tell you. If we come to your doorstep knocking for this information and you deny us, contract is gone. You're no longer a contractor.
Money spigots turned down.
And that's great to hear, because that means that they are demanding some accountability with stuff. It's fantastic. Right. And
keep in mind, our black budget back in, say, around 2004, so when all this started with like Nimitz, our black budget back then was around 50 to 60 billion. Last year, I believe it was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 to almost 200 billion. So it has grown substantially. It definitely grew quite a bit after 9/11. And there we have a valid
reason.
It's
a lot of money to fund a shadow government.
Well, yeah, and think about it. We have a black budget that's larger than almost every other country's entire
budget. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's just our black budget. So we've got $1 trillion going into essentially the defense, and there needs to be accountability, because there's a lot of opportunity for misappropriation, and I get it.
But yeah, absolutely. And Mike,
hopefully they do their job and get that done.
Oh man, I want to thank you as always for coming on. Not just coming on, but coming on last minute notice.
Hey, no problem.
You wear a cape and a cod piece for this show for many, many years, my man. And you are a great friend to always be there, even in our side conversations. I love you, man. Thanks so much for everything that you do.
You too, bro.
Just out there in the world, because it's insane some of the things that pop up on your doorstep. So Godspeed to you. Thanks so much for covering this as long as you did tonight. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to tune into more 5x5 News, where they can go to follow you, where they can go to keep up. You're on the X. You're on the X.
I couldn't even find my Twitter. I was like, where did Twitter go? And then I remembered, let me check under X. And sure enough, on my phone, there it was.
There's the X.
So you can find me on Twitter or X, formerly known as Twitter, whatever it's called. So that's where you'll see current conversations and things that are just up to the minute of discussions that are going on. You'll see me argue with people like Ryan Graves and so forth, on there and what have you. So, yeah, and that's where your most important need to know at the moment information is going to be. On YouTube, that's where you'll see where we put up some of the information that we've compiled over time, and we're trying to present it in a more tangible form that's a little bit more observable than 140 characters or something. So those three places will be your primary locations. Also on Facebook, just search for 5x5 News in Google, and you'll find just about everything that we do. I don't think there's too many other 5x5 News is out there, but we should pretty much come to the top of that third one to do. So
absolutely. Well, Mike, once again, man, thanks so much for taking the time to come in, really break down this panel. I greatly appreciate it. Stay in touch. Be safe out there and everything that you're doing, bud. All right.
You got it, buddy. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Take care, man. I'll be sharing links and everything as always.
Sounds good, brother.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Oh, man. Always great talking with Mike Turber. Always a fantastic conversation and always revealing. While you're online checking out everything from Mike Turber and 5x5 News, stop on by curiousrealm.com/videos. That is the easiest, fastest way to subscribe to the 5x5 News channel. All you have to do is click his little logo there, 5x5 News. It'll take you right to his YouTube. We have all of our guest YouTube channels embedded here, folks. Make sure while you're online checking out curiousrealm.com/videos that you stop on by our store. That's where you can find books from the guests. It's where you can find our merch. And of course, curiousrealm.com/story. That is where you can share your experience of the paranormal cryptid encounters. If you were a whistleblower yourself, if you were a targeted individual, share with us your story and we will share it with our experts and try to get you some answers. Stay tuned through this commercial break, folks. We will be joined by our good friend Kathleen Ball to discuss her new book, A Grail Quest. Exactly what is a grail quest? How does one get charged with one? And what answers come to you in life once you've found out that you're on one? We'll get into that and so much more with Kathleen Ball right after this, folks. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much, Mike Turber of 5x5 News, for always coming on. He has come on. I would say him and Dr. John Hall could probably hop in a ring and duke it out for most appeared guest on Curious Realm and Dudes and Beer combined. But I want to thank him for always coming on. There have been numerous times where I've called him literally hours beforehand. I had another guest promoted and life happens, and it's like, hey, man, guest had to drop out. Can you hop on? He's always been there, and he's always there to cover these hard topics like the recent congressional hearing from the whistleblowers. That was incredible stuff, and we are crossing into new worlds, folks. Speaking of new worlds, there is a whole new world in A Grail Quest, the new book by our good friend Kathleen Martin, forward by our other good friend who connected us with Kathleen Martin. Gretchen Cornwall wrote the forward to this. I have been ready for this to come out. Last time we had Kathleen on, we were talking about the Knights Templar in Brazil, the Templars in Brazil documentary series that she'd done with Freddie Silva. And welcome back to the show, Kathleen Ball. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here, Chris. I'm doing great. I'm doing really good. The book came out on the 18th, and it's doing really well. We've had a lot of sales and a lot of interest, and it's resulted in some opportunities that have opened up for me.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's available on Amazon. The title is A Grail Quest, Discovery of a Mysterious Knights Templar Cave in Brazil.
And
it's basically what it is. It's the backstory of my discovery and several things that led up to that discovery. As many people know, you know, my life has been a quest. And I think anyone's life can be a quest if you just get out there and, you know, follow your bliss, as Joseph Campbell said. Just keep getting out there, you know, just follow what's in your heart. And I think your life just sort of turns into a quest, which is what's happened with me. And that's basically what the book is about, is about all the circumstances and things that led up to this discovery. Some of them were mystical experiences. I met a nun in Marseille, you know, who led me to St. Baume. There's just all sorts of things. One of the representatives from the dungeon in Dome gave me the keys to the dungeon so I could go in and photograph all the Templar glyphs that were in the dungeon that, you know, Jacques de Molay and the other Templars that were held there, they etched into the side of the dungeon walls. And wow. If I hadn't had that experience in 2009, I would not have recognized the Templar cross and the markings inside the cave.
And for those who may not be familiar with you, you do have a PhD, and it's interesting that you went from the world of art.
Yes.
To studying the Knights Templar, and in not like a cursory study of the Knights Templar, like you're saying, to the point that your studies led you on expedition actively out to the Amazon to find this cave that apparently has Templar markings inside of it in Brazil. Absolutely phenomenal. Here's the actual footage of the locals there getting you ready for your journey, all that kind of stuff. It was, tell us a little bit about how you came from the world of art and painting and sculpture, which your work is amazing, Kathleen. But how did you go from that to studying the Knights Templar to begin with?
Well, I always, as a side study, when I was, you know, when I was getting my education and doing my undergraduate bachelor's degree, I was literally on the fence if I was going to go archaeology or fine art. And I had already sort of been offered a job. I had a pretty good idea that I was going to have a job in the art department locally. So I went with that. I went ahead and got my master's in fine art and focused on sculpture, figure sculpture and anatomy, because we needed an anatomy teacher up in the mountains. No one taught anatomy in the art department, any of the art departments. So that's what I focused on. But on all my breaks, my spring break, my winter break, I was out on digs. You know, I was out on digs locally in Sacramento area in the mountains and the Washoe people up in the Sierra Nevadas above Auburn. I was out on digs and studying, and then I started traveling, going to France, going to, you know, excavating, and just, you know, that was my life, going out to sites. That's really what my passion. I was kind of, actually, my passion was kind of both. And so that really fed my artwork. If you followed my artwork, it really is documents all of my research and study, including my metaphysical studies. So, you know, you look at my artwork, I've got, you know, the Mesopotamian gods and goddesses, Sumerian gods and goddesses are in my work. The Nephilim, the giants and the daughters of men was one of my art installations. My study of Kabbalah, I did a huge installation that traveled all over the world. It opened in San Francisco in 1999, and it was the Union of Opposites. And that just, you know, that just took off and traveled all over. So it wasn't really a big jump when I got back to Brazil after discovering the cave, and my house burned down 9 days later. Whole property burned down. All my artwork, all my curriculum, everything that I had, all 20 something years of curriculum and art, 30 something years of artwork, and all my entire art collection, everything we owned. So after that, 6 weeks later, I had a liver transplant. So I had a year, I decided to give myself a year to recover from that. And in that year, I basically had to recreate myself. I really had to recreate a career and shift gears, completely shift gears. So the first thing I started doing was I started taking people on tours, which I had already done a little bit of anyway, to Egypt and South America. And I started doing local lectures about ancient sites and their pertinence to our world today and why these ancient sites are so important. Mm. Anyway, and that basically led me into a decision to turn my discovery of the Templar Cave in Brazil into a documentary. And that really was the turning point. When I made that decision, it just changed my whole life. And so I found someone that was willing to produce the film, which they did an excellent job, a beautiful job.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah. NEXT and Neil Cabana were my producer and co-producer, and they really did a fabulous job. So we got it out on Gaia TV. And then everybody kept asking me, well, how did you find this cave? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the backstory, right?
Please.
What's
the backstory? Buy the book. No. You want to know the story, buy the book. I'm just playing.
Well, you know, people had been after me for years because my life has not been typical. I have had a very, very interesting life. Put it that way. Very, very interesting life. And I've had people ask me for years, for the last 30 years, to write a book about my life. And I thought, you know, I just didn't see the importance. Well, so finally I saw the importance. I saw, okay. So this could really benefit people. Not only would they, can they learn that their life can be a quest, but also that, you know, you can really open yourself up to wonderful things, really wonderful discoveries and people and cultures and so much more. When you just make a decision to just go with the energy, you know, that's what I did. I surrendered to a higher consciousness and energy, and off I went, and I'm still on it.
Well, and you know, it's interesting that I love the fact that even whenever we originally talked and you were talking about writing the book and calling it a Grail Quest, after hearing your story and meeting you and talking with you, I thought it was a fantastic title for the book, because a Grail Quest is individual. It is separate and unique for each person. There is no, it is very much, I guess, almost like that Philosopher's Stone concept, you know, when it comes to alchemy. And the idea of you changing yourself so that you are worthy to receive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a series of surrenders. You know, I look at the house fire as a initiation by fire. I mean, literally, because it transformed. I did a painting of it because what I saw the night that the fire was happening, which was September 11th of 2015, and I did a painting of it because it was such a powerful impression that I got during a dream state of me being in the middle of this fire with flames all around me and everything I own being changed back into its subatomic state. And I could manipulate those atomic elements into anything I wanted. And it was really interesting because that really precipitated walking through a portal to a whole new life. I stepped out onto, you know, from that experience into a liver transplant, and then boom,
yeah.
You know, I lost some hearing. I lost quite a bit of hearing, enough to where I had to have a cochlear implant, so I couldn't teach. I wouldn't be able to go back to the college and teach. And so it was like, okay, you really have to do something different. You know, you really have to move in a different direction. So it's changed my life in so many ways. I can't even explain. And the most recent, in 2021, when I went back into Brazil to gather more information about the cave, which we'll get into in a minute, I was actually invited by the Amazon tribe, the Huniquin people, in Brazil, the Amazon jungle in Brazil. I was invited to come in and interview their chief in regards to how the Templars may have gotten from Bahia into central Brazil. And it turns out that they were actually led into that, into central Brazil with the Amazon tribes. So what happened there, I had absolutely no, I couldn't possibly have foreseen. But while I was there, I had been struggling with the NR rejection meds, the immunosuppression from my liver transplant. Everyone who has a transplant is put on immunosuppression drugs that are very, very
aggressive.
They're toxic, basically. Yeah. Very toxic to the body. So after, you know, here I am 7 years, almost 7 years post-transplant at this point, in 2021, I'm 6 years, actually 6 years post-transplant. I'm having some serious problems. I have hearing loss. I've had nerve damage, just all sorts of things. And so I had been doing some meditations and just some really spiritual things, alchemy in regards to this. And I really wanted to get off the injection meds. So the chief basically said to me, what is your heart's desire? What do you want to achieve here? And I said, I want to get off these anti-rejection meds. He said, okay, so you want to participate in the ayahuasca ceremony? I said, absolutely. And it was totally unplanned, 100% unplanned. And I did. And this was my second experience, or actually fourth, my second experience in going into the Amazon jungle. I also was in the Amazon jungle in Peru in 2013. But so I had experienced ayahuasca before. I had healed some tumors in that experience. But this time I actually had a healing from the anti-rejection meds, and I haven't had to take them since. And it's been over 2 years now. So the doctors have all signed off on me. You know, I had a lot of for a long time. I have labs in my book. You can see it. We're documented where my liver functions were normal. And I have been off the anti-rejection meds since. So from my perspective, that is one of the things that, you know, is interpreted in Grail Quest for some people are healing. And I have experienced two healings as a result of my quest. And I'm not done yet.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because when you talk about the Knights Templar, Kathleen, when you talk about the, quote, treasures of the, and don't get me wrong, there were massive physical treasures of the Knights Templar, all right? But when you are specifically talking about the Grail, when you are specifically talking about this idea in history, anyway, I have always been of the mind that the Grail, capital G, was an esoteric concept that they brought back with them. It was a capital T truth. Whether that was based upon the Kabbalistic teachings that they learned, the esoteric teachings they learned being there on the Temple Mount, also being involved with Islam, all kinds of things, they came back with a new sense of enlightenment. And new concepts and technologies, even when last time we had Gretchen Cornwall on, we were talking about her recent work into the Knights Templar and alchemy and their use of alchemy. And I even made mention of the fact that one good reason for them to come to America is we're one of the world's best deposits of copper. And they actively used nanoparticles of copper inside of their color red for their stained glass. That is what made their unique color of stained glass was nanoparticles. So like even the technologies that they used for stuff like that and their building, phenomenal and amazing knowledge that they came back with. And yes, very much the idea of having a Grail quest, once again, the idea of purifying oneself and preparing oneself for that capital T truth.
Right. Right. And the Grail quest can be many things. You know, the yeah. Templar, the original Templars, of course, they actually organized back in 1049. I mean, this was far beyond what we've seen and documented in history. And, you know, they actually originated in Greece, which is interesting because I found Templar crosses all over the place in Athens when I was there. And then into Constantinople before they went to the Holy Land. So this is much, much earlier than what we have typically understood the yeah. Templars been organized. So so these things were going on, you know, prior. And if my research, the line of research that I'm working on right now, if my research is accurate, and I have every reason to believe it is, there were actually a order of knights that was organized by Zerubbabel at the second building of the temple in Jerusalem. And they were organized to protect the builders of the temple, the second building of the temple. And what I suspect, and I'm going to be going to Portugal in October to investigate and research this, but what I suspect is that through Mason Marks and through some old family records, I may be able to link that order with the order that arose in 1049 and eventually the one we're aware of in 1099. I think that they were the same families because so much information was passed down orally, especially with the Jewish, you know, people at yeah. that time. So much was passed down orally. And I think that a lot of information as to where to go in the Temple Mount, I mean, when they were right down into the tunnel system underneath the Temple Mount, how did they do that? How did they know to do that? Okay, that's what yeah. I look yeah. at the obvious, you know, I look at the obvious. What does that tell me? Who goes someplace and just starts going and digging through the rubble and even knows there is tunnels underneath the Temple Mount? Right. And then they come back and all of a sudden they've got all these new building, you know, building abilities. They start building ships. The Portuguese were the first shipbuilders that we know of, modern shipbuilders.
Yeah.
And they had the only, you know, the only navy I would be considered a fleet of naval ships. And they were traveling all over the world. I think they were traveling far edges of the globe, not just the Americas, but I think they're in India as well. There's some evidence that there's Templar crosses and insignia in brickwork in India as well. So my personal belief is that they traveled far and wide. They just kept it under their hat. You know, with Brazil, when they went into Brazil, when they came back, they called Brazil Vera Cruz, which is the true cross. Yeah. But what they did was lead everyone to believe in Europe that it was an island, not an entire continent, but an island. And the reason they did that is because they didn't want interest in it. They didn't want anyone to say, oh, okay, now we got a big continent we have to conquer. Yeah. And they didn't want competition. And the same thing with the gold, which I think I talked about the disclosure of the cave that I found being a gold mine. I'm pretty sure I talked about that with you. Mm-hmm. And it verified it absolutely was a gold mine. And at the time in 1307, King Dennis in Portugal was broke, just about, you know, just all, actually all the monarchies were yeah. that participated in the Holy Land, in the wars in the Holy Land. And so it really fit into this scenario, into the narrative that the Templars had discovered gold mines in Brazil because they, what I believe, were bringing back gold into Europe. They were making multiple trips back and forth. And we also know now, as in Peniche, Portugal, we also know that King Dennis, he actually promoted and paid for, supported a military base there in Peniche. So she's on the coast of Portugal and for the Templars.
Mm.
And it was all quiet. Nobody, you know, this was not above board, because what was happening at that time is the Catholic Church was trying to shut down the Templars. So this was all quiet. It was all kept under the rug. And the Templars were going back and forth with King Denis's blessing and bringing them gold. I mean, Portugal, if you look at the later in the 1300s, was a very wealthy country. Very wealthy. Okay, so anyone who was bringing gold and silver into the country was valued, which I think probably had something to do with the fact that King Denis agreed to suppress the Knights Templar, and but recreated him as the Knights of Christ in Tomar, right?
Yep.
But it all fits. And I look at the obvious, what makes logical sense in the narrative? What makes, you know, when you don't have, when you have lack of historical records because they were suppressed, what makes sense? Look at the the chronological order of events and try to figure out how those things happened or how they could have happened. And so that's what I've been doing.
Well, and especially tracing things back, like you were saying, from Portugal to the New World, as you were saying, they didn't want anybody to know that Brazil was the size that it was, for fear that they would come and, well, do what they did, you know.
Right.
That's just what Europe, that's pretty much what we all did and still do, Kathleen. I'd love to say it's different from century one to now. It's not. It's horrifying. But it's true. And you know, you have to wonder, because we're even still prone to the same thing right now. I mean, heck, the conversation we just got finished having with our guest before this was literally, hey, where are you getting the money from, guys?
Yeah.
You know, because apparently you've had this technology for decades, not been telling the people with the purse strings, and yet still somehow sneaking money through. And that's just it. Like, when you're talking about the King of Portugal, not only subsidizing these journeys for them, but keeping it on the down low, because that is where they went after. Right. After their persecution from the King of France, who wanted them to basically muscle the Jewish people to help pay off his debt. And they were like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. So he declared them heretics, had the Pope come after them, and burned all of them he got to catch.
Right. As many people know now, it's been disclosed that, you know, his reasons were entirely selfish.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to become a Templar himself. He wanted to be part of the order. They denied that. And so, you know, he got upset about that. And also, he owed him a great deal of money, and he wanted to not have to pay that back. He didn't want to pay it back.
Yeah, it was like, hey, you can have free reign over these people, take care of my problem, and anything you loot from them, you can keep.
Right. And so that was the power of a king, you know, in the medieval time frame. I mean, that's just, that was a reality. A king said something, and that was it. That was the gospel. So not only did he cancel his debt, but he also was able to get everything that he could, you know, all their properties. He missed out on the treasure, but you know, I mean, most of it anyway. I think it was taken out probably into La Rochelle and into Portugal and wherever else they could get it out, and how they could get it out.
Into Tomar and.
Right. I think that, you know, it was dispersed throughout. And I think we're going to find out more about that Templar treasure within the next probably 5 to 15 years. I don't know. I expect that to surface here pretty soon. And we already have, you know, the lost relics, Carl Cookson and Hamilton White with the cache of Templar relics, which show. The other thing, too, it showed, getting back to what Gretchen was talking about, it showed that there was an esoteric aspect to the Templars.
Oh, absolutely.
There were ritual items in that cache that the lost relics program presented, and they were beautiful. They were
amazing.
They were absolutely amazing. And I think that we're probably going to see more of that as more people are on the hunt. You know, there's a lot of people that think that I'm going to discover it. I don't know if that's the, if that's true or not. And, you know, I have told and I've let it be known that if I do discover it, I'm turning it over to the Templar Order. I have no desire to keep it or any of that for myself. I would definitely turn it over to the Templar Order, who I believe it was where it belongs. And so they can further their agenda, because I believe that they have rebanded, you know, come back together during this time frame to assist in this whole process that we're all going through right now, the raising of consciousness, changing of our evolutionary path collectively. And I think that they're very, they have a vested interest in that.
Yeah.
You know, basically my belief is based on interviews with specific Templars, and also the fact that what they did in Portugal was to create a nation that was an example of that. You know, when they conquered the Moors and Islam in Portugal, they all invited them to stay. They gave them land. They gave them farmland. Yep. They gave them, you know, and not only that, but they took in the Jews. They took in the Cathars. They took in all the people that were considered heretics by the church.
Yeah.
And they created a nation that was, it was a sovereign nation that was accepting of all belief systems and cultures and religious backgrounds. So here we have an example, the only example in Europe at the time was in Portugal. And oddly enough, Alto Paraíso, where I found the cave in Brazil, is exactly a replica of that same thing. We have people from all walks of life, all religious backgrounds, all cultural backgrounds, all living together harmoniously in this area that happens to be a triangular form of Moinho, San Jorge, Alto Paraíso, and Cavalcante. So here we have a replica, a replication of what they had done in Portugal, in Brazil. And it, you know, it's no accident that the cave was right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, when it comes to exploring the cave, when it comes to getting to the cave, Kathleen, what was it that led you to that cave to begin with?
Divine order. I had absolutely no intention of exploring and looking for a Templar cave. That's, I can tell you that. I was out exploring with a girlfriend. We were just exploring the beautiful waterfalls. There's ancient waterfalls in this area, Chapada. They call Chapada National Forestry Area in Brazil. It's about 3.5 hours outside of Brasilia. And it's one of the most beautiful areas I've ever seen in my life. Surrounded by waterfalls. And we wanted to see, we wanted to go and visit some of these waterfalls. We were heading up to see John of God in Abadiânia. My girlfriend Adele Good was working for John of God at the time. Anyway, and we had a couple of days to kill, basically. So we went up into the Chapada and we ended up at this waterfall site of this man who said, hey, you want to have some lunch and we'll just talk about the waterfalls or whatever. And then during that conversation, he invited us to go to the neighboring property and see this crystal vein that was about a meter high by about a meter in width that went the length of about 2.5 kilometers through the center of this property. And there were crystals just all over, scattered all over, thousands and thousands of them. Anyway, wow. So of course, you know, that sounded intriguing. So we did that. And then we went down into the cave and he said, let's just go cool off, drink some water, eat our snacks. There's a cave down here. So we said, sure. Went to the cave. He lifts up the branches and I'll be darned if there wasn't a Templar's cross right above it. And then I'm looking at the cave itself and the cave has been hand carved. And I'm just like, whoa. This looks exactly like some of the markings I saw in Dome, France, in the dungeon where they held the Templars, especially the crosses. So it was absolutely fascinating. I was just stunned. you know, especially I was not looking for it. It was just, I feel it was divine. It was just part of my destiny. That's when I spoke with one of my researchers, Joao, at the Camelot Pousada, which is a hotel in just outside of Alta Paraiso. He said to me, he said, "This is your destiny." And I had also another person when I went into Portugal tell me the same thing. And I really believe that it is, because these things just fall into my lap. I mean, they really literally fall into my lap. And also, you know, I also believe in, we hold in our DNA, we hold aspects of our genealogy and our descendants, our ancestors. And I am a descendant of the Templars myself on my father's side. So I think there, you know, that plays into this whole thing as well. And I just, I'm also open to it. I'm very open to it. I've always been open to energy. I've also always been open to, energy. I've been open to energy ever since the near-death experience I had in 1990. And I'm very open to where the energy leads me. And I've been led on some very interesting discoveries.
Now, this cave that, as you said, was used for mining gold, things like that, does it, what do the locals say about it? Has it been there since prior to the expulsion of the Templars, or was it there after?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about that, but I do know when I interviewed the Kalunga people, which I don't know if you're familiar with the Kalunga.
No.
They are the runaway slaves that escaped the trade ships that came in the 1500s.
Oh,
and,
wow.
They escaped into Alta Paraiso, and guess where they hid out? They hid out in the Templar caves. So I know for a fact that they were there before the Kalunga came. And according to the Kalunga, the caves had been used for ritual purposes, that there were ritual symbols and things in the caves.
Interesting.
And they were spiritual places, according to them. That's what they called them, spiritual places, kind of like a church, but places where people would go to pray and to meditate and to do spiritual practices and initiations. And they were used for this all the way up until the 20th century. According to the locals, the old women still go into that area. The spiritists in Brazil still go into that cave and perform ritual.
Fascinating. And to know that, now, was it a pre-existing cave that the Templars expanded on and turned into a mine, or was it just a mountainside that they began excavating?
Yeah, it looked to me like it was all carved about the same time as hand tool marks.
Wow.
Looked, you know, impossible media evil tools. And I believe that it was done by the Templars. I think sometime between 1290 and 1350 is the dating that I have established at this point, based on the gold finding and also the gold that was put into Dennis's coffers at that time, and their ability, and also the expulsion by the King of France. I think that many of them were also looking for, you know, they were looking for other places to go to escape the claws of the church.
Yeah.
So, the story goes, as the story goes in Brazil, the Templars came, many of them stayed, and they married into the indigenous people that were already living there. And there's actually a farm right below where I found the cave that belongs to a woman. Her name is Leonia. And I interviewed her, and we believe that was a Templar ranch or territory at some point. She has a sluice box that comes down into her property.
Oh, wow.
And also a mill wheel that is a medieval mill wheel 1300s on her property that she showed me. So I photographed, and it's, I think there's a photo of it in the book, as a matter of fact.
Wow. That is pretty remarkable. And to know that, once again, we've talked with numerous researchers, even Dennis Stone recently, the owner of America's Stonehenge, about the possibility of Knights Templar visiting America long before Columbus.
Oh, yeah.
Made it over here. And that's something that, even being a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, that's something that I remind people about over the bar at meetings all the time, is don't forget that dude was following a map.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That dude knew where he was going when he got lost. And landed somewhere that he wasn't trying to go.
Right. You trace that map, it goes back to his relatives' ancestors who were Templars. So, you know.
Well, even the cross on the front of Christopher Columbus's sails, you know. Right. Yeah.
So the other thing I found in the cave too, which I wanted to bring up, is the last time I went in, because the first three times I went into the cave was filled with bats and spiders. And the first time I went, I was literally covered in spiders. They were crawling all over me. And when I turned on the light, my flashlight, I was covered in these spiders. So I didn't go into the cave and really explore too much until the last time in 2021, when I went in with my metal detector and, you know, and really explored. The spiders were gone at that point. But what I found were some very interesting crosses. Not only were they replicated in Dome France, on the walls in Dome France, but they're also replicated in Peniche. In Peniche, Portugal. Here we go again. It's another tie to the port, Portugal, and also in Istanbul. So, which was Constantinople at one point. So here we have these crosses and insignia that date back to 1099, at least 1099, on a church in Peniche and in Istanbul, which of course was Constantinople. So we have these crosses. So there is a possibility that, you know, they could even have carved this cave and been in Brazil even earlier than what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And to know that, number one, they didn't go anywhere without building.
Right.
Anywhere they went, they built. And even if this was the building that they were doing at the time, which, once again, using it, I'll pop that picture up again with the cross over it and everything else. Not necessarily using it, because as you said, sure, there was gold mining going on there and everything else, but according to the natives, it was more used for religious uses. Things like that, which, you know, they made many a grotto everywhere that they went, for prayer, service, and initiation ceremonies.
Absolutely. And there's also the fact that there are three more caves too. And, initially I thought they were on the same property. On my last trip, I actually found out that they're in Cavalcante, which is a town located about 45 minutes from the cave. So I suspect that these caves are probably scattered throughout the area. They're probably on people's property, because we're talking wilderness. We're talking, I mean, literally wilderness. There is nothing out in this area. Very small towns in between thousands of miles of nothing, but just, you know, raw land. So the chances of there being more than just the cave I found are pretty good, I would say. They're pretty good. And I have been told that there are three caves that the Kalunga stayed in Cavalcante. They're on Kalunga territory, land. And my next trip is to go in and investigate those.
Now, during your course of investigation, not only for the Brazilian Templar mystery film, but for a Grail Quest, what has been probably the most remarkable thing that you have found that has really changed your concept, Kathleen? Because, of course, that is a huge part of a girl quest, is that heel turn that happens in somebody's life. And once again, to randomly stumble on this cave, on its meaning, for this thing to suddenly pop up in your life and to now basically consume your life and be a major part of your work.
Right.
What has been the biggest change point for you amongst all of this?
Well, I think what's happened for me is it's come full circle. You know, my PhD is in metaphysical studies, and I studied metaphysics for, I still am studying, for, you know, 25 years before I got my PhD, and I continued to study it. And if I'm correct, if the Templars were organized by Zerubbabel, and that would lead me to believe that there were probably an esoteric group of people that were bringing information forward, because you got to remember that the Temple Mount, the temple itself, the second and the first temple, were both built according to sacred geometrical principles.
Absolutely. Okay?
In order to have this information, you had to have or been involved in some sort of secret society, whatever you want to call it, esoteric group of human beings that were interested in bringing these concepts forward in time to the present time. Okay, and I believe that's what the Templars were doing again in the 11 to 1300s. The same thing by building all those temples and all those cathedrals all throughout Europe. They were bringing these concepts forward into the present time. But why? Why were they doing it? Why were they so interested? And I think that it was, you know, somewhere along the line, they believed that this is a time frame that we're living in right now, that revelations would take place and that there would be a change. You know, some people look at Revelations, the book of Revelations, and say, you know, there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. That's one possibility. I don't know personally what is going to happen, but I do know that we are undergoing a tremendous change in consciousness right now. And I think the Templars were invested in that bringing forward of that esoteric knowledge, which is something that after I had my near-death experience, I've been committed to. That's a commitment that I made with my soul and my heart at the time of my near death when I decided to come back. And I have been invested in that and revealing the esoteric beliefs and revealing the raising of consciousness and how, you know, concepts of how to do that ever since 1990. So here now I've come full circle with the Templars' agenda. And my agenda have become one. And so what's happened is I've also embodied that in my own being. And now I move forward as not just a Templar researcher, but also a Templar researcher invested with the belief that we will have an esoteric change of consciousness on this planet. And that's, you know, that is everything to me. That's my existence. That's my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those, Kathleen, once you are awakened to that, and I don't care what your creed is, what your belief is, metaphysically, period. Once you are awakened to that fact in life, it's hard to look the other way.
Oh, it's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's just say this. It takes a certain kind of person to look the other way.
It's not an easy path. You know, I guarantee you. The first 17 years of that path, I had a liver disease, which resulted in 4 years of living with liver cancer. I had 29 cancer tumors. You know, it is not a walk in the park.
How much of, and this is an honest and spiritual question, Kathleen, how much of your physical suffering do you believe was a grail test upon your quest?
I think it was all for the purpose of strengthening my faith. You know, I had a really interesting conversation with Ian Ferguson the other day. Last week we had did a podcast, and he mentioned some concepts of that many of the people in this world today that have, you know, volunteered to come back have these genetic memories of some sort of psychic attack that was so bad that it shattered parts of our soul. Yeah. Okay. And it really rings true with me. It really does, because I believe that what's happened to many people, when you're burned at the stake, for one thing, when you're burned at the stake like that or skinned alive or whatever, it is shattering to the soul. So when you die that way, it's so traumatic that it's difficult in your, you know, in your ongoing lives after that. Have faith again. You know, it's difficult. So I know when I was born into this life, I just had a belief in the creator. I had a strong belief, but there were certain things that when I started advancing in my quest, even as a child, that I started to turn back because I was afraid. I became afraid. So once I had the near-death experience, I was no longer afraid of death. That was it. I just lost that fear. Mm. And so all of these things, including the 17 years of liver disease and cancer, et cetera, what that served, the purpose it served was to strengthen me spiritually. And all of these things have continued to strengthen my resolve as I've moved forward throughout this quest. And, you know, the challenges can do two things. They can send you back, or they can cause you to move forward.
Yeah.
You know, they're either going to propel you one way or the other. You either give up or you mount the challenge. You know, you climb the mountain and you get to the top and, you know, and you go the other side. So what happened with me was I continued to climb the mountain.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's... It once again, like you said, it's not easy. It's not easy. And I think that's part of what most people don't understand, Kathleen, is that you might think, yeah, I want to go on a Grail quest. I want to do these things. Do you? You know. Once again, the people I have spoken with who let's just say have had experiences with the paranormal, extraterrestrial, things like that. The people who populate these shelves in my studio, Kathleen, these are the grails for people. These are the things that listeners are like, oh my God, yeah, I want that. And it's like, really? I don't know if you've read the book. Because, because are you ready for the 17 years of trial and tribulation to come to the point of realization, to only to realize that, like, well, now I've got work to do.
Right.
You know, exactly.
and now things are getting really real, you know, so,
well, it's kind of like there is, and just to make this parallel between the Knights Templar and Masons, you know, there is a rank in Masonry that you hit where the whole lesson of that rank of Masonry is for you to learn that everything you've learned before that is a falsity.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Because the only way you're going to be ready to receive these next lessons is for you to understand it's all a lie, dude.
Right.
and
that's what you find out.
Yeah.
That's what you find out. And you just keep going because your search for truth becomes more important than anything else in your life.
Mm.
And it involves a great deal of sacrifice. It involves, you know, it's not a walk in the park. No. And many people, we see a lot of people today spiritualists. They want to guide you here and there. They want to teach you how to, you know, how to work with sacred stones and different. They want to teach you all this stuff. But that really is all beside the fact. You know, those things are just beside the fact. I like to even sometimes refer to them as irrelevant because they may be guiding, you know, there may be guideposts. It's like I may see a stone, you know, some type of sacred stone, like made out of lapis or something that look and go, oh, that's interesting that that's placed there. Okay, something I might need, I must need to pay attention to something. And what will happen is someone will come in and say, hey, I need to speak with you. And it'll be a shaman or someone who's giving me instructions for something that I need to do. Like when it happened with that nun, you know. But they're not in themselves. I don't know how to say that. They're not in themselves the point. You know, they're not, that's not the destination.
Yeah. Yes. You know? They are a tool with a message.
Absolutely.
And that's just it. You know, it's kind of like, a modern witch saying that the power comes from an athame or even from the crystal. No, that is what we, at least in the Catholic Church, and what the Knights Templar would call a sacramental.
Right.
That is what you are using to help fix your mind and your concentration on something.
Right.
Same as using incense and lighting candles in church. That is to represent something that is beyond us and to put us into a mind space to be in a certain place.
Exactly. You know, and they assist us to go inside ourselves.
Yeah.
Access the sacred, because that's where it is, you know.
Yeah. And that's just it. Are they necessary to do that? Absolutely not. You could go out and find that sacred literally in the middle of an open field if you wanted to, sans assistance of anything. However, do they help set a scene? Absolutely. You can watch Shakespeare delivered by a dude in a black turtleneck against a black curtain. And it's impactful. You can watch it on a stage with a huge production too.
Right. and it's the purpose is to move you into that realm of understanding the spiritual, of allowing it to come in, to open yourself up to the spiritual, you know? And that's the purpose of those things. And I'm even curious, you know, which brings to mind is the Ark of the Covenant, you know, that, the Ark of the Covenant. Now everybody's searching for the Ark of the Covenant again. And one thing I wanted to bring up that I think is very important is the fact that the king of Ethiopia used to make numerous treks into Tomar, Portugal, to visit none other than the Templars. And also the Templars made reciprocal treks into Ethiopia.
Yep.
So this also leads me to believe that they were involved in something very, very spiritual, esoteric belief system, something very ancient that they were aware of. I believe that they probably knew the location of the Ark of the Covenant. And I think that that has something to do with, and it may even be revealed during our lifetime. I would love to see that happen. But they were involved in some very secret practices and had access to some very, very powerful things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. They number one, were monks before warriors. And really understood if there is one thing that monks understand, it is the aesthetic, the fact of losing, not having, the fact of being able to get away from everything, live in poverty.
Yeah.
give everything to somebody else. And it's interesting that their life as monks, I think, is what really opened them to this spiritual path in the way that it was. I don't think that if you had a rabble of general knights that were even charged by the Pope, I don't care if they were all gathered together from the best of the best of just knights of Europe. Right. I don't think that they would have had the same outcome, even being called Knights Templar, what have you. Right. It was their monk status that took them down the path of the esoteric.
Yeah, there's two important things. There's two important aspects of that. Okay. One, yes, they were on a spiritual quest and they had you had to your elite members. These esoteric beliefs and practices were not practiced by all of the Templars.
No.
In order to establish their Grail quest, I believe that was done via the Crusades, because you were facing death every day, probably every minute, every second while you're over there. You're surrounded by, you're surrounded by Islam. But what they chose to do was not only meet those challenges, but also they went and met with the Sufis and the, the Islam, the masters is all are over there, and they actually joined with their enemy on some level and communicated with them and came away with esoteric belief systems that they practiced. So they were also, many of them were also very respected by their enemy, supposed enemy, right? I mean, Saladin certainly had a great deal of respect for many of the Templars.
Yes.
Because of their ability to face death like they did.
Yeah.
So this is an important aspect of a Grail quest, because you do come face to face with your own death on numerous occasions, numerous types of incidences that you come across during your quest. I know I have had countless experiences of facing my own death.
And those experiences, Kathleen, especially the ones, like you said, bringing you close to death, having to face that and even consider that the way that you were with your pancreatic cancer. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question to you. How did those experiences and those brushes with death change your relationship to wanting to find out this information and wanting to research this more?
Surrender. Mm-hmm. That was the key. Was every time I came across one of these situations, it was another level depth of surrender to all of creation, to our creator, to the quest, to truth. It was just another continual level, and it just continues to be another continual level of surrender, which the physical death is the final surrender. But these are steps along that way. And the other thing that it's caused me to face, which the Templar I share with the Templars, is that you mentioned temptations. I have given up all temptations. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't have, I don't have any kind of anything in my system, and haven't in 30 something years. Just temptations, all of the temptations you can think of, I have managed to surmount and move forward and move away from those temptations. It's like, I don't have addictions. I don't have temptations in my life. I don't have compulsions in my life. And awesome. I think this is true with the Templars as well, is once you enter into this journey, this destiny, that's what happens. Jesus, he went through the same thing in the desert, right? And he was 33 when he went through. I was 33 when I had my near-death experience. You know, I think these parallels are important in people's lives. And again, I want to emphasize that, you know, I think that anybody can step out of their life once they realize that they look around and they go, oh my God, I work at a bank 9 to 5. I come home. I do the same thing every day. I'm in debt up to my ears. I've got a mortgage. What am I living for?
Yeah.
What am I doing? What am I doing in this life? And, you know, everybody come, well, not everybody, but many people come to this moment of truth in their life where they just like question everything. And, you know, we see so many people in our society, they start drinking, they start taking prescription drugs, they suicide. Yeah. I mean, any number of escapes. There's a lot of ways to escape. But basically what you're trying to escape is facing yourself and finding out who you are.
Yeah.
Being who you are, the truth of who you are. And for me, it also involved going through a lot of past life experiences and facing some pretty ugly things about myself that I really didn't see, but they were part of my journey.
Yeah.
Right? Out many lifetimes, they were part of my journey. And I had to look at those things and just basically embrace that dark side. Yeah. And balance it within myself. And that's, you know, that again, that's something that the Knights Templar did as well, I believe, because, you know, judging from the way their demeanor, as it's described to us, that's what they were about. They were a balance of good and evil within their own beings. So that told me that they went through initiations, of their own to achieve that state.
Yeah. And speaking of states and initiations, I think my audience would find it very unbecoming of me if I let the mention of ayahuasca, not just a single ayahuasca journey, but a second ayahuasca journey, Kathleen, be mentioned without asking. Do you feel that your ayahuasca journeys, plural, were individual? Do you think that they were individual or tied together? Did you have similar experiences in both of them? And how do you think they related to your Grail quest?
Well, the first time I went into the Amazon jungle was in Peru, and it was very different. The ayahuasca is mixed differently.
Yeah.
And again, I was going with the intention of a healing, and I had connected the shaman, the ayahuasquero, 3 months before the trip. And I had been preparing myself by not eating meat and sugar and white flour and all these things, and preparing myself spiritually. I talk about it in the book, this preparation that I went through. Yeah. Of, you know, emptying myself of identities and personalities of artist, teacher, mother, woman, wife, blah, blah, blah. And so I went through this emptying until I got to Peru. And then I arrived basically empty, you know, without, it was a little identity as I could do, right? And so when I surrendered, in the first ayahuasca ceremony, and ayahuasca, by the way, is not a recreational drug.
No. Yeah. Don't never, be going to any backyard parties, folks, things like that.
It is definitely not a recreational experience.
Yeah.
It is specifically for a spiritual quest. That's what it's used for. And that's what happened to me. The first three were linked. The first three experiences were linked, and I talk about it in my book. I really am very, very open about what the experiences were about in my book. And first, it was an emptying, seeing past lives. It turned out that I had an experience where I was related to the ayahuasquero in a previous life 5,000 years ago, many, many thousands of years ago, involving child sacrifice. And I was not proud of my participation with.
Oh, wow.
We were able to make amends, and it was a beautiful experience. It was beautiful. And that opened the door somehow to the next part of the next phase, the following night, where I went in, and that's actually where I did the healing of the tumors in my liver. I had 7 when I left the U.S. Wow. I had 1 when I got back. So wow. I was able to go into my own genetic makeup, and I saw like little Pac-Man. It was really, really interesting that were just eating these tumors. They were just eating these tumors. And it was really, it was kind of comical when I think back on it. But anyway, and then the third experience, I actually did a little bit more healing of my liver, kidneys, my spleen at that time. Enough, it actually was enough to keep me going until I had the actual liver transplant. I think if I hadn't gone through that ayahuasca experience, I don't think I would have made it to the transplant. I really don't think that would have happened.
Wow. Now, you don't think you would have made it to the, not through the transplant, but to the transplant?
I don't think I would have survived. No, I don't. Wow. I don't, because Western medicine at the time, their cure for these tumors were to take me in and do this chemotherapy, embolization, and shoot the tumors full of chemotherapy, and they were destroying my body. I mean, it literally,
it's a destructive process. It's horrifying.
Right. And there were still little bits of the tumor, and there were left residual pieces. And so I was continually getting more tumors. So after this experience with the ayahuasca in Peru, I didn't have another tumor for like 9 months. That was the longest stretch.
Wow.
I did not have any tumors. But then they started up again because I had a liver disease, And I think to this day, I really believe that if I would have stayed in the Amazon jungle at that time, I probably could have healed my liver entirely. But I was teaching still. I still had responsibilities here in the U.S. And that was just not something I could do.
Yeah. That's remarkable because, indigenic medications are remarkable. We are just now starting to microdose people with mushrooms and things that native cultures have used, and they've looked at ayahuasca. Ibogaine is one that they are seriously considering for withdrawal, that kind of stuff. It's really interesting to see where the indigens are being used and how they are being applied in modern scientific use.
Absolutely. And, I think one of the biggest, one of the most potent properties of ayahuasca is it puts you into surrender state. It's beyond, I think it's even more powerful than a theta state. So you are in a state of receptivity for healing. And then you also understand and realize that you are in control of your own biological processes. And you can go in and do things and manipulate things. And in the fourth experience, when I was in Brazil in 2021, that's exactly what I knew exactly what I was doing at that point. I mean, I knew exactly what I was doing. Surrender. I did it all in one ayahuasca experience. The surrender process went in. I emptied myself of fear, and I describe it in my book as well. And then I just opened myself and surrendered to the power of love, the universe, and the whole tribe was surrounding me with love. It was a beautiful experience. And I asked for this healing to take place. And I literally went into my own body and made this liver my own. So it's a done deal.
Wow. Wow. And like you said, after that experience, no more rejection meds.
That's right.
Anything like that, which is remarkable. My brother a couple years ago went through a full immunotransplant, and the science that they have now, even now, Kathleen, he had stage 4 lymphoma, and it was one of those we have. about an option and maybe half of another one. And one of those options is very extreme.
Yeah, right. It's very extreme. And how does that, you know, the second part of your question was, how does that relate to the Templar or, you know, the Templar agenda, the Templar quest? And again, it just tailors right into the Templar agenda of the initiation experiences. And here we go. I mean, there is some, what did they use this chalices for? You know, that Carl Cookson and Hamilton White found, right? What was contained in those chalices? Would love to be able to get some samples, if there was any possibility of getting some samples of what was contained in those, because I would suspect it was some type of, you know, hallucinogen of some sort, or possibly even ayahuasca. Who knows? If they were in Brazil, they certainly had access to it.
Oh, most definitely. And I mean, aside from that, they had asked, like you said, had they gone to the Far East or anything like that, guaranteed would have been running into traditional uses of mushroom, all kinds of things for initiation ceremony, even the use of acacia wood.
Absolutely.
From the Middle East. Like, not many people realize that the whole experience of the burning bush with Moses and the bush that was non-consumed by fire, that was acacia. That it was. And yes, it burns very uniquely when it's on fire, but it also emits a pretty hallucinogenic smoke. Not that Moses did not converse with God. I mean, I had my own religious experiences aside from acacia wood, but these things are used, they are used for numerous things. I mean, the ancient Greeks as well as the Egyptians both used lotus petals and wine, all kinds of things to bring themselves to another state for religious initiation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was used all over.
Yeah.
The ancient world for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, we fast forward to the 20th and 21st century and it's illegal. But we are starting to break those walls down. You know, we are starting to change things. And Graham Hancock goes into this a great deal. I have a lot of respect for him and his basic mission, you know, to attempt to break those walls down.